who the next president's going to be.
It's going to be dramatic.
And of course, that affects us all.
America Decides.
Throughout next Tuesday night from 10.
I'm looking forward to seeing how this night plays out.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 30th of October. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robbins.
The headlines today: as she prepares to deliver one of the largest tax-raising budgets in living memory, the Chancellor is promising to put more pounds in people's pockets. Throughout the programme, we'll hear what today could mean for your payslips and benefits, for business and for the future economy. And BBC News has been told the most senior government figures knew in the past few weeks that the teenager accused of the Southport murders could be facing further charges.
And in today's programme, on the morning after, Kamala Harris warns of chaos and division if Donald Trump is elected next week, and he warns of soaring inflation and illegal immigration. Campaigners for both parties tell us how they're feeling about the last few days of the election campaign.
We are so used to having elections that are razor thin that we're used to being nauseously optimistic.
No, I'm just straight up excited. The back of my car is full of Trump signs.
We assess what Israel might do next in the face of international criticism of their decision to ban the UN agency UNRWA. And 50 years after this moment,
somebody in Fraser's corner is saying he ought to be stopped. They're arguing about it. And Eddie Fudge is calling it off. He's calling it off. It's all over. And Muhammad Ali at the end of the 14th round.
Why that fight between Ali and Foreman, the fight, the rumble in the jungle, has continued to capture the world's imagination. The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will deliver what could be one of the biggest tax-raising budgets in a generation this afternoon, with a pledge to put more pounds in people's pockets and grow the economy. Ms Reeves is expected to say her priority is to invest, 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 but will warn that there are no shortcuts to restoring economic stability. A rise in the minimum wage by nearly 7% is among the measures. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
For the first time in 14 years, a Labour Chancellor will hold the famous red box outside number 11. Immediately, it's expected this budget will be one of the largest tax raises in living memory, anchored by a £20 billion per year rise in employers' national insurance, but more on capital gains tax, inheritance tax, and from a prolonged freeze in income tax thresholds. The need to raise already high taxes even higher is driven by a strict new self-imposed constraint, never to borrow, to fund day-to-day public spending. This is designed to ensure tranquility in the markets and low interest rates. There are risks here about the burden being shouldered by businesses, especially small ones. The Chancellor is making a post-election judgment that the public prioritises getting public services running effectively and will back an emergency injection funded by higher taxes.
BBC News has been told that the most senior figures in government became aware in the past few weeks that there could be further charges against the 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July. Axel Rudakabana is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. Both Conservative leadership candidates said the government had questions to answer about new charges. Here's our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
To charge a suspect under the Biological Weapons Act, the Crown Prosecution Service has to obtain consent from the government's law officers, the Attorney General or Solicitor General. The BBC's been told that in this case, consent was requested in recent weeks and granted within days. A spokesperson for Sir Keir Starmer said the charging decision and its timing were a matter for the CPS, and it was not correct to say the government had been involved in withholding facts from the public. The police have reiterated that the attack is not being treated as a terrorist incident. Authorities are warning that speculating about what possible motivation there might have been could lead to the collapse of the court case.
President Biden is facing criticism after appearing to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage during an election campaign call. His comments have overshadowed a rally by his vice president, Kamala Harris, in what was being billed as her final big pitch to voters in Washington. Mr. Biden was condemning remarks made by a comedian at a Trump rally on Sunday who called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage.
Or Puerto Rico, where I'm in my home state of Delaware. They're good, decent, honorable people. The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization is seen as unconscionable, and it's un-American.
President Biden later clarified that he was talking about what he called the hateful rhetoric spewed by the one single Trump supporter who made the comment. Officials in eastern Spain say that a number of bodies have been found after torrential rain triggered flash floods in the Valencia region. Earlier, it was reported that at least seven people were missing. Spanish media have reported that there was more than a month's worth of rain in a single day. A new study into the health effects of climate change suggests that almost half the Earth's land surface had at least 1 month of extreme drought last year. The annual report, published by The Lancet, found that at the same time, extreme rainfall had increased. Our population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty has more.
Since the 1980s, the area of the world's landmass affected by drought has tripled. In the 80s, 15% of the world saw drought for 1 month or more, and last year that figure was 48%. The increase has been particularly dramatic in Brazil, which saw 9 months more of drought last year compared with a baseline of the 1950s. Somalia saw 10 months more. Last year was the driest year on record. It was also one of the wettest. This analysis from the Lancet Countdown on Climate and Health found that 61% of the planet saw an increase in extreme rain in the last decade when compared with the 1960s. Many places are facing a double hazard. When intense rain follows drought, the soil is especially vulnerable, causing severe damage to agriculture and to public health.
Cumbria police say a significant fire has broken out at a BAE Systems dockyard in Barrow, where the UK's nuclear submarines are built. Officers say there's no nuclear risk, but two people have been taken to hospitals suffering from suspected smoke inhalation. The Royal Mail is to start using digital tags or smart stickers to track posts through its network. The scheme is designed to improve efficiency and cut carbon emissions. Our senior technology reporter Chris Valance explains.
Transporting the post has moved on a bit since Auden's Night Mail crossed the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order. Recently, a variety of drones have been deployed by Royal Mail to bring the post to island communities. Now the company is trying out attaching electronic tags to the 850,000 wheeled containers called Yorks it uses to move post across its network in an effort to spot inefficiencies and cut its carbon emissions. The tags will help create a live digital map of the containers' journeys. Eventually, the Royal Mail says it may tag individual parcels to monitor the carbon footprint of each item.
Chris Valance reporting.
Thanks very much, Lisa. It is 7 minutes past six. Sunshine or dark clouds for Rachel Reeves. Matt Taylor at the BBC Weather Centre has the answers. Matt?
A little bit of a mix out there, actually, Johnny. Today, right across the UK, we've got high pressure with us. It will be with us for not just the rest of this week, but even into next week, keeping things predominantly dry. But the problem is, quite a bit of cloud has got trapped underneath that high pressure, and that means for some it will stay fairly grey. In Scotland, for instance, in southern areas of Scotland, we've got an all-weather front producing cloud and a few spots of light rain or drizzle at the moment, but it will brighten up in southern Scotland. Central and northern Scotland, a fresh start, but a sunny start for the vast majority before the Hebrides, Orkney and Shetland will see some cloud and outbreaks of rain later in the day. For Northern Ireland, again, a weak weather front produces lots of cloud, isolated spot of drizzle this morning, brightening up into the afternoon, better chance of some sunny spells developing for most places. Across England and Wales, large amounts of cloud across both countries this morning. We are seeing a few breaks though, and it's across parts of southern eastern England, also the Channel Islands, most likely to see some longer sunny spells develop at times, but even where you've got the cloud, it will brighten up every now and again. Temperatures today across the UK, well, northern Scotland around 11 to 13 degrees, vast majority though, 13 to 16 degrees, still around 2 degrees above where we should be for this stage in late October. tonight, a mild enough night for many. 5 to 8 in eastern Scotland and central and eastern England, where we've got the best of the cloud breaks, but a few mist and fog patches could form, most around 8 to 12 degrees. And as for Thursday, whilst many will be dry, varying amounts of cloud, a little bit of sunshine here and there, far north and northwest of Scotland will turn wet and windy.
Thank you very much indeed, Matt. It's 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. You might think they would lead on the budget on this big day, but most lead on the teenage suspect in the Southport stabbings being charged with producing ricin and possessing a study of Al-Qaeda material. The Mail says police made the discovery within days of the attack. The Times leads on claims by two Conservative leadership contenders that police and the government withheld information about the suspect. A government source tells the paper that Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch are peddling what they call conspiracy theories, and to do so on the back of heartbreaking losses in Southport is, it's argued, despicable. The Telegraph notes Downing Street's denial of a cover-up. The Guardian highlights a plea made by Merseyside police for people not to speculate about the alleged offences.
There is, of course, a pile of budget news and speculation. The Financial Times leads on the cost of long-term government borrowing reaching its highest point since the general election yesterday, as the Chancellor prepares to deliver the budget. The FT says Rachel Reeves has £50 billion of headroom for borrowing, and she'll be hoping the markets react calmly. The Daily Telegraph reports that the armed forces are in line for a funding boost of nearly £3 billion in today's statement. It said the money will fund a backdated pay rise of 6% for personnel, as well as the replenishment of weapons stockpiles left depleted by arms donations to Ukraine. It means, according to the Telegraph, that defence spending as a proportion of GDP will remain at roughly 2.3%.
The Mirror uses its leader column to praise the government for increasing the minimum wage by 6.7%. The paper says the move will create a genuine living wage and make work pay. But the business group, the Institute of Directors, warns in the Times that the change, along with an expected rise in employers' national insurance and new legislation on workers' rights, will create what it calls a perfect storm for firms. The Daily Mail's editorial condemns the budget as being nakedly destructive and ideological. The paper says Rachel Reeves is hobbling business at every turn, and should focus instead on trimming the public sector and getting more people into work.
Ukraine and Russia are holding preliminary talks about halting strikes on each other's energy infrastructure as winter looms, according to the Financial Times. A Ukrainian official tells the paper that Moscow and Kyiv have already reduced the frequency of such strikes after their respective intelligence agencies came to an understanding. However, a senior figure at the Kremlin explains to the FT that Vladimir Putin is unlikely to agree a total halt until Ukrainian forces withdraw from Russia's Kursk region.
The Sun reports that a flight from Heathrow to Austin in Texas was delayed because of a punch-up over a woman wearing a red Donald Trump Make America Great Again hat. A brawl is said to have broken out in Terminal 5 after another woman demanded she remove the red baseball cap and was met with refusal. The pair are said to have squared up again in the premium economy cabin before they were both removed. A source at Heathrow tells the Sun that tensions over the US election are, wait for it, sky high, and the crew couldn't risk a punch-up at 30,000 feet.
It is 12 minutes past six. Well, the papers have their last day of budget speculation. Soon we'll get the real thing. Listening very keenly will be our cost of living correspondent, Kevin Peachey. Kevin, we've ruled out the big top-line tax changes that people see very quickly in their pay packets. What is it that you're going to be looking out for?
Yeah, it's always give and take in any budget, isn't there, Johnny? And also, people were looking individually at the direct and indirect impacts on their money. And I think this is where it's going to be very interesting today. So we've had a pre-announcement of one of the big giveaways, one of the direct impacts, the minimum wage rates rising, £12.21 an hour for if you're 21 or over, £10 an hour if you're 18, 19 or 20. That is slightly lower than the last couple of years. But then when we, by not touching those three main rates, of tax, well, then we get into more complex areas. And as we heard there, if, as expected, the national insurance rate for employers goes up, well, then we may see one of the indirect impacts, according to business groups, and that's on job creation, pay rises, maybe prices going up because there's this extra burden on employers. There's obviously the cost of getting to work may go up for some with that cap on bus fares going up in some parts of England. They take a keen look too at fuel duty, whether there's any changes there. So you can see there's lots and lots of things happening. I think it's going to be a packed budget. Another key thing which we've talked of many previous budgets is tax thresholds. Sounds a bit dull, of course, but it's very important because it's the point at which people pay income tax. And if that's held at the current level, frozen at the current level for longer, then clearly as people get a pay rise, it can drag you into paying higher rates of tax or income tax at all.
Kevin, thank you. We will leave you to what will no doubt be a very long and interesting day. Kevin Peachey there.
Indeed. And over the next 3 hours, we'll mark your card on what we do know about tax and spending and borrowing and investment and all the rest. It's coming up to 6:15 now. She says America will be ruled by chaos and division if he wins. He says she's presided over soaring inflation and illegal immigration. Last night, the two candidates to be the next president of the United States made their final pitches. Our correspondent Samira Hussain watched Kamala Harris speak in Washington, D.C. and told me why her old boss may have overshadowed the message.
On the one hand, you have Kamala Harris really presenting herself as the next president, you know, appearing very presidential, speaking from the ellipse with the White House in the background. But yes, her boss may have just eclipsed her in terms of his political gaffe. He was speaking at a Zoom event with Latino activists in which he was responding to this comment that was made by a comedian over the weekend at a Trump rally, where he said that Puerto Rico is a floating island of garbage. Well, in response to that comment, President Biden said, well, the only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. Now, of course, the Biden administration, or rather President Biden, took to social media very quickly to try and backtrack any of those comments, really making the point that he was referring to that particular comedian and his comments and not to all Trump supporters. But now the question very much for the Kamala Harris campaign is how much damage has this done? Remember, we're only 6 days to the election and it is incredibly tight. So anything could tip the scale.
It's very striking these last few days, isn't it, that the message coming from both campaigns is they, the opponent, doesn't like you, our supporters.
Very much so, because they're both trying to get at that very small number of undecided voters, those who have not yet decided if they want to see a Harris presidency or another Trump presidency. And all of this really hinges on these battleground states, these seven states that could really tip the scales in any direction, which is why both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump will be hitting all of these battleground states in the next 6 days.
Samira Hussain, thank you very much indeed.
Well, the investment world will be watching Rachel Reeves' words very closely and the numbers, of course, behind them as government borrowing costs hit their highest level since June. Sean Farrington's with us. He's got more on that.
Yep, we'll be watching those closely. We'll be hearing lots of talk about the impact of the bond markets, which can feel a bit mythical sometimes. This world where big investors around the globe effectively lend money to the likes of the UK government. If they have more confidence in the financial prospects of our economy, the cost of that borrowing, the interest rate on it, can go down. And if there's less confidence about those prospects and those investors think there's an increased risk of not getting their money back, interest rates can go up. And that cost of government borrowing has a ripple effect through the economy on the cost of mortgages, business loans and more. So if we have a look at the 10-year bond, where lenders to the UK expect their money back in 10 years' time, demand interest on it each year, the yield on that, as it's called, effectively the interest rate, has risen to 4.3% in recent weeks from 3.75% just a month or so ago. One of the biggest investors in that bond market is PIMCO, and its UK economist is Peder Beck-Friis. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why has that cost of borrowing gone up recently?
Well, I think markets have been a little bit nervous over the last few months. So gilts have underperformed other markets. As you say, the 10-year yield in the UK is 4.3%. That's now broadly on par with that in the US. And normally in steady state, we tend to think that UK borrowing rates should be a little bit below the US. So I think it's fair to say that the market has built in a little bit of a risk premium leading up to this market, but certainly not to the same magnitude as what we saw 2 years ago.
So when we talk gilts, we are talking about UK government bonds there because of the gilded edges to those bond certificates. So how does this compare to the market mood after the Liz Truss mini budget when borrowing costs increased then?
Well, again, there's a little bit of a risk premium but certainly not the same magnitude as during the Liz Truss budget 2 years ago. So back then, the UK borrowing costs on the 10-year point went up about 50 basis points relative to the US. So again, at the moment, the UK borrowing cost on the 10-year point is broadly on par with the US. So certainly not... markets are not as nervous as they were back then, but a little bit of a risk premium is priced into the UK borrowing gilt curve.
There's almost always some surprises one way or another on budget day. What could unnerve investors like yourselves at PIMCO today?
Well, I think there are a few things that we will be looking out for. First of all, the fiscal deficit, not only today's or this year's fiscal deficit, but also the path ahead.
So is that how much we're borrowing each year?
That's correct. The second thing is the what's called the gilt remit, how many bonds the government plans to issue this year. That will be important for the bond market as well. And then third of all is around the fiscal rules, how they precisely will redefine the target measure of debt and how much headroom they will leave relative to that new fiscal rule.
So this is all about that increased wiggle room on borrowing to invest that Rachel Reeves may well have when those rules are adjusted. Is it possible today that too much of that newfound room could be used up in the announcements? And you and investors like yourself thinking, well, why are you spending all this or this extra borrowing so quickly?
Well, that is not our expectation. We would be very surprised if the government announced anything that would lead markets to question the fiscal credibility, the fiscal stability that we have seen in the UK over the last few years. Our expectation is that the government will cut the deficit going forward. And in that environment, we don't think that the market should start to question the credibility that we've seen over the last 2 years.
Peder Beck-Fries, UK economist at that bond giant PIMCO, thank you very much. So confidence of investors, key, as will the confidence of those running businesses around the country, employing millions of people in the process, the confidence of households, their willingness to spend or not, how could all that be affected? Steve Rigby is the co-chief executive at the Rigby Group, one of the UK's biggest family businesses, employing more than 8,000 people, running infrastructure across IT, airports, hotel sectors. Morning, Steve.
Morning, Sean.
And Fiona Eastwood joins us in the studio here, Chief Operating Officer at events giant Merlin Entertainment, Thorpe Park, Alton Towers, Legoland under its watch, 8,000 people employed as well. Morning, Fiona.
Morning, Sean.
Being described, Fiona, as a perfect storm by the Institute of Directors in the Times today. So this conversation we've had many a time, national insurance, minimum wage, employment rights, costs all rising. Would you describe it as a perfect storm?
It's certainly challenging, given the challenge we're already having this year in the economy and consumer confidence that we've seen hit throughout the year.
So the consumer confidence has been hit throughout the year. Have you noticed that change in the weeks running up to the budget with all the messaging we've had about what might be to come for the country?
Yeah, we saw an uptick in August, and we also saw that then come through in our business and the wider hospitality business. And then we saw a dip in September, and we've seen increasingly the impact of the concern around a lot of this doom and gloom messaging.
Steve, for you, alongside those potential tax rises, wage rises, the ramping up of investment levels part of the plan as well. Can it be a perfect storm for business when investment plans are as the government has them?
I think, Sean, thank God we're on budget day, and this speculation that we've all been going through comes to an end today. So I think we have to look at everything in the round as we approach today, both, as you say, measures around investment as well as taxation. I think it's going to be the combination of those two and the balance, which is a really fine balance that I sincerely hope the government has got right, that will allow us to say whether we've got confidence moving forward. And I think, you know, obviously the US election next week is also a very pivotal moment. But there afterwards, if the balance has been achieved, then hopefully the combination of investment and tax does allow us to climb out of where we are.
Right. Do you think family businesses like yourselves, will families be more or less enthused to start a business in the UK, to grow their business, at giving the announcements that are coming?
Yeah, there's no doubt, Sean, that there's a combination of announcement here that which could compound errors. I think the news overnight around national living wage is significant for certain industries, for hospitality, for retail especially. I think for those family businesses operating in that arena, I think the combination of national insurance, national living wage and employers' rights is a meaningful shift. So I think we have to balance what comes out of the budget and understand where that is. And I think it's really important, not only is there a tax roadmap, but specifically around national living wage, where we've seen 29% increase in the last three budgets. I think, you know, we've got to consider where that ends. And is it practical to have inflationary rises that are trading at three times inflation on an ongoing basis? So I would urge the government specifically around that national living wage, which is important to close the inequality gap. I'm all for doing that, but just trying to balance it behind which costs can be passed on by business and which costs have to be absorbed in people's profitability.
Fiona, you're also a director at the UK Hospitality Industry Group as well, and a sector impacted by many of those things Steve talks about there. What is at stake today if the Chancellor doesn't get the balance right? When you hear concerns from those members, you even look at your suppliers at a massive business like Merlin.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of UK Hospitality, we released today that these measures, the rumoured ones, and if they're true, it's about $1.9 billion to the hospitality wage bill. We did a survey this month and of our members, and 29% reduced profit this year, 12% broke even, and 18% operating at a loss. So with these increased costs, you could see 30% of those businesses going under.
So 30% businesses going under. How has that expectation changed after all of the mountains that these businesses have had to climb in recent years, from trading rule changes to COVID to energy costs and everything that came with the food cost price hikes, everything like that? These have all been challenges for your industry. Is anything changing on the back of these latest ones?
Look, I think a lot of these businesses are still reeling, as you say, from COVID. They're still paying off the debts they had to take on in COVID. We all want to see people having more money in their pocket. That will drive demand. But these are costs that are going to impact all of those businesses. So something has to give.
Steve, is there a moment today, you alluded to it before, about some uncertainty ending? How much difference does that make, given from the world of business for so long, with all those challenges I just mentioned, the word uncertainty has relentlessly come up at this time of the morning on the programme. How much difference does that make if you feel like you know the environment you're working in for a good while?
I think it makes a radical difference. You can start to plan on the long term. And I should say, whilst the communications from the government haven't been the best in the first 100 days, that's not the case from Treasury and the Department of Business and Trade. They've really engaged business both before coming into power and post. So I think they have really reached out. I do believe strongly in the growth agenda. I think it is at the heart of government. So if we can get that long-term vision today and we can see an element of confidence returning back, obviously any tax rise has an impact. People are going to be affected. But we do have to consider where we are, not just in our country, but internationally. And we still remain, from a taxation point of view, substantially beneath our European counterparts. If we can grasp that and the current momentum that was in our growth trajectory until perhaps 2 months ago, I do think there's a fighting chance of us getting out and actually becoming one of the leading economies in Europe. And
Fiona, just briefly, you trade right around the world. How do we compare?
Yeah, so if I look at the US, that's been very stable in the last few years, and we're seeing a very robust performance. The flip side of that is that China is the impact of a lot of lack of confidence in the consumers. They're keeping their savings because there are no efforts to tackle that economy in a big way. So we are seeing a weaker UK, but as you just said, hopefully with some of these measures, we will get that stability and we'll be able to invest even more in the UK economy.
Fiona Eastwood, Chief Operating Officer at Merlin Entertainment. Steve Rigby, Chief Exec of the Rigby Group. Thank you both.
Sean, thank you very much indeed. 28 minutes past six. It's not always Manchester United news, but it does feel like that at the moment in the sport, Mike.
It's just when you're on, Nick, you see. That's what it is. Yeah, big day for Rachel Reeves delivering her first budget. Big day for Ruud van Nistelrooy too, in charge for the first time of Manchester United as interim manager. They host Leicester City in the League Cup. It may well be the Dutchman's only game in temporary charge, in truth. United have agreed to pay Sporting Lisbon the £8 million release clause for their head coach, Ruben Amorim. The 39-year-old Portuguese is now assessing his options. United, of course, looking to replace Erik ten Hag, who was sacked on Monday. In the League Cup last night, Premier League sides Southampton and Brentford both made heavy work of beating Championship opponents to reach the quarterfinals. Next to qualifying for next summer's Women's European Championship and late drama in Cardiff.
And it's Holland to win it! And she has done! Wales lead! And Kerry Holland may have just sent them through to the playoff final. Wild celebrations!
Yes, Wales are through to the Euro 2025 playoff final after that dramatic extra time winner over Slovakia kept their dreams of reaching a first major tournament alive. Kerry Holland's late goal sealing a 2-0 win on the night, 3-2 on aggregate. They will now face the Republic of Ireland over two legs next month. Elsewhere, Northern Ireland, hoping to make it to back-to-back Euros, also scored an extra time winner to beat Croatia 2-1 on aggregate in Belfast. They'll next play Norway in the final playoff round. Scotland, meanwhile, cruised through with a 4-0 win over Hungary. They now have to beat Finland to reach next summer's finals in Switzerland. England have already qualified. They beat South Africa 2-1 in a friendly in Coventry last night, but manager Serena Wiegmann still not happy with what she called some sloppiness in her side's performance.
You can scream or do anything about it, but we want to take that out. We're really aware of that, but we also have to move on. This is done. We had it now. We move forward, and the next game we're going to do it better again.
Briefly elsewhere this morning in rugby union, scrum half Ben Spencer will make his first start for England in Saturday's Autumn Nations Series opener against New Zealand at Twickenham. Whilst in cricket, England have named all-rounder Jacob Bethell in their squad for the three-test series in New Zealand. Whilst the British tennis number one, Jack Draper, cruised through to the second round of the Paris Masters. And just to mark your card, our sporting guest later this morning is two-time Grand National winning jockey Davy Russell, who, amongst other things, talks to us about his struggles making weight for the big races, revealing what he used to have for breakfast before the big race at Aintree.
I had a couple of eggs that morning, yeah, and maybe a cup of tea. You'd have a cup of tea when you get to the races. That's all you got. And the odd time then you'd have a little square of chocolate just to give you that little sugar kick going out the door.
More from Davy Russell in the next hour of the programme.
Thanks very much, Mike. It is 29 minutes to 7 and now a message from Children in Need.
Maths book. Pencil case. Oh, water bottle. I always forget that. Trainers. Calculator. Anxiety. I'll bury that at the bottom.
Some children carry more than others, but with our help, their mental health issues can feel lighter. BBC Children in Need. We're there for you.
Time now is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson, and Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Chancellor is preparing to deliver her first budget, pledging to put more pounds in people's pockets despite big tax increases. Rachel Reeves is expected to say that she'll prioritise investment, but she'll warn that there are no shortcuts to restoring economic stability. The BBC has been told that senior government figures became aware in the past few weeks that there could be further charges against the 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July. Axel Rudakabana is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. President Biden has been criticised for appearing to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage. Mr. Biden said he'd been referring to remarks by a comedian at a Trump rally who described Puerto Rico as an island of floating garbage. A new study into the health effects of climate change suggests that almost half the Earth's land surface had at least 1 month of extreme drought last year. The annual report, published by The Lancet, found that at the same time, extreme rainfall had increased. The increase in drought has been particularly severe in South America, the Middle East and the Horn of Africa, posing a risk to food security and sanitation. Emergency services are tackling a significant fire at the BAE shipyard in Barrow-in-Furness, where nuclear submarines are built. Police say there's no nuclear risk, but two people have been taken to hospital suffering from suspected smoke inhalation. People in the area have been urged to stay indoors and to keep their windows and doors shut. The Royal Mail is to start using digital tags or smart stickers to track posts through its network. The tags on containers carrying mail will help create a live digital map of the containers' journeys. The scheme is designed to improve efficiency and cut carbon emissions. Eventually, the Royal Mail says it might tag individual parcels to monitor the carbon footprint of each item.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. 26 minutes to 7. Invest, invest, invest. That's what Rachel Reeves says she'll do in her budget speech today. The first, in case you've forgotten, by a Labour Chancellor since 2010. So a very big moment indeed. A big moment for our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. The Tories will no doubt say invest, invest, invest is a code for spend, tax and borrow.
Well, that's something that actually Labour people privately are gesturing at. A couple of weeks ago, a senior advisor to Keir Starmer told other advisers to Keir Starmer that this budget would be characterised by their opponents as high spending, high borrowing and high tax. What I think has become much clearer in the last few days, and especially overnight, is that Rachel Reeves is going to make an argument that this is all for a purpose. And the purpose isn't just to, as they would see it, clean up the Conservatives' mess, fill the so-called £22 billion black hole that they inherited, but to invest. Invest in public services in general, but in particular in the NHS, as we were hearing yesterday, and in schools. It's high spending and increasing taxes, but with a clear purpose. And that purpose, they're arguing, is investment.
We always have to analyse the words that are released from the Chancellor on budget morning to try and work out what they're signalling. And here's a bit that puzzled me. Rachel Reeves saying that she will put money in people's pockets. This despite the fact we're told it'll be the biggest tax increase in decades.
Well, clearly there is disagreement over whether what is clearly going to be an increase in the employer's rate of national insurance amounts to a breach of the general election manifesto or not. But what is not in question is that the other bits of that manifesto pledge, no increase to the rates of income tax or VAT, stand. So that, I think, would be a clear way that they say they're going to hit what Rachel Reeves has said there about protecting pay slips. The other thing is that, as we heard last night, another bit of the budget that we know in advance is that the minimum wage is going to go up substantially, especially for over 21s. It will go up to £12.21 an hour, but an even bigger increase for the lower rates that younger people are paid to bring them closer. So I think that is one way that they will protect people's payslips. On the other hand, let's remember the so-called stealth tax, fiscal drag. Thresholds are going to be frozen further into the future than currently planned, which means that more people, as they get pay rises, are likely to be dragged into higher rates of tax. Rishi Sunak, we've had a preview of his response to this budget, which will be basically his last moment as leader of the opposition, last moment as Conservative leader later today. And he says, far from protecting working people, if she increases the employer's rate of national insurance, she would be raising literally the only major tax that specifically hits working people. And notable that the Liberal Democrats are also opposing that inevitable tax rise on national insurance because they say it would hit small business.
Henry Zeffman, busy day on Downing Street for you. Let's turn now to our business editor, Simon Jack, who will also be having a very busy day. Morning to you, Simon. The Institute of Directors say that all that we've just heard, higher taxes, higher wages and more rights for workers, adds up to a perfect storm for business.
They're certainly being asked to bear a lot of the brunt of a very big bill. Of the $40 billion she's trying to find in this budget, more than half of it is coming from business. $20 billion in national insurance, as you were just hearing there. You've got $5 to $7 billion in that inflation-busting minimum pay rise. A lot of people will say this is a very funny sort of pro-growth, pro-business type of budget. I think that's the big risk here, is that by loading up and making business the biggest bearer of this, you deter growth, you deter people hiring people. And I think that will be the experiment. Now, that's why I expect at some point her to say, there's got to be some kind of growth carrot here for business. Maybe it's a commitment to adjusting business rates, a bit more tax for the out-of-town Amazon type warehouses, a bit less on the high street. And she'll also say, look, I'm going to give you a roadmap. I know this is painful, but we're going to give you some stability and some visibility of future taxes. We won't be back to do this again because we don't want to have a budget like this again, but asking businesses to stomach quite a lot. And then you've also got, of course, with this extra money for investment, how are the markets going to react? I think she'll be well within the 50 billion of headroom. I think markets have had enough notice of this to not sort of have the kind of panic you saw after the Liz Truss budget 2 years ago.
Yes, her pitch to business and to the markets is you get certainty. You don't get chopping and changing as you had in recent Conservative years.
Yeah, I think there were two very different audiences. If you go back to the investment summit that was a couple of weeks ago at Hampton Court, that was the big message to international investors, which is that you're going to be dealing with the same people for the next few years, unlike the chop and change you've seen before. And I think for business now here domestically, I know this is painful. This is a one and done type of affair. We're going to give you some visibility. Bear with us on this one. Have they pushed it too far? You've had a lot of people, institute directors, calling it a perfect storm. A lot of people saying they've taken too big a bite out of business. And what they were trying to promote, which is pro-growth, pro-hiring, they may have compromised their ability to do that, because the initial whirlwind romance with business has certainly cooled if you look at the business index confidence indexes over the last few months.
Simon Chat, thank you. We'll hear from two big business leaders at around 7:30.
It's 21 minutes to seven. There are some terrible images coming out of Gaza this morning following an Israeli airstrike in the north of the Strip. The Hamas-run health ministry there says 93 people were killed or are missing as a result of a strike on a block of flats in Beit Lahia. And the US has been very strong in its criticism. A horrifying incident with a horrifying result, said a State Department spokesman. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem. Yolande, very strong words from Israel's ally. What do we know of the attack on Beit Lahia, and what are the Israelis saying about it?
Well, this was an Israeli airstrike on a residential building several stories high. Neighbours said that there was no warning in advance, and they were just trying to pull bodies out of the rubble with their hands yesterday, and said that there were children among those killed. 93 Palestinians said to have been killed or missing, but dozens more wounded as well. And of course, there's very little in terms of medical services now in the north of the Gaza Strip. The US came out with some strong language at the State Department. The spokesman said they'd made clear to Israel they want to know exactly what happened. How could you have a result that produces, according to reports, dozens of children dead? He said, we don't yet know the answer to that question. I mean, the Israeli military, when I asked them for an update, they just said they were aware of reports that civilians were harmed. They were looking into it. They said that there'd been targeted operations, and that the north of the Gaza Strip, in that area, they'd already given evacuation orders in recent weeks. They described it as being an active combat zone.
Yolande, Washington is ever more insistent on getting aid into Gaza, and it's linking it very directly to US military assistance. The US is just saying that Israel's words are not matched by its actions.
That's right. And there's been, of course, more focus on this, given that the main UN agency that's been responsible for distributing aid in Gaza, there was that legislation that was passed at the start of this week by the Israeli parliament, basically banning that in Israel and banning Israeli officials from coordinating with the agency. So we had also at the UN Security Council yesterday, the American ambassador saying that Israel's words about getting more aid into Gaza must be matched by action on the ground, and really saying that, you know, there is this letter that was sent on the 13th of October demanding that Israel take steps within 30 days to let in more food, medicine, other supplies into all of Gaza, and especially the north. But at the moment, they're not seeing that that's happening.
Yolande Nell in Jerusalem, thank you very much.
18 minutes to seven. Quick look at the morning's front pages. A lot of coverage, of course, of the budget. And it always depends which paper you read for the political slants on news, but also for who the target market of newspapers' headlines are. So the Mirror in particular highlights the news about the increase in the minimum wage, Up the Workers, it's its headline. The Eye, Reeves hands 6.7% wage rise to lower earners as millions face painful tax increases. The Guardian has that on its front page too. Whereas, unsurprisingly, it is a paper like The Times that focuses on the worry about amongst business leaders, budget rises and workers' rights add up to perfect storm for business, its headline. And the FT worries about the market. UK borrowing costs hit post-election record on eve of Reeves's first budget.
The charging of the suspect in the Southport attack is the other big story on the front pages in the Daily Telegraph. Southport attacker possessed Al-Qaeda manual. Suspect alleged to have carried out knife rampage charged under Terrorism Act is its subhead there. The Mirror, terror manual and toxin found at home. In the Times, claims of Southport cover-up. And the Daily Mail, perhaps the most political front page there. Southport suspects had ricin poison and Al-Qaeda material. That in quotes, as new charges revealed, top Tories ask, why didn't authorities tell public sooner? Some of the front pages there on those two big stories dominating those newspapers. It is 16 minutes to seven. It's finally here after weeks of speculation, months of speculation, really. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will set out the details of her budget later. But yesterday in Parliament, the row over how much of it has been trailed in advance rumbled on. And there was a last minute appeal for help for small firms. Here's our parliamentary correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Regular listeners will remember that we reported yesterday on the Speaker's stern ticking off for the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. Sir Lindsay Hoyle was cross because, with the budget on the horizon, she'd announced a planned change to the government's rules on debt and borrowing to journalists first and not to MPs in the Commons, something he described as a supreme discourtesy. 24 hours on, a Conservative Shadow Treasury Minister, Laura Trott, reckoned Labour had come up with an odd justification for its pre-budget briefing.
The response from Number 10 yesterday seemed to be that their whole argument is, we did it because you guys did it.
And Laura Trott thought that wasn't the change the country had been promised.
We are learning the lessons of why we lost the election, but this government seems to be taking lessons from the worst bits of our record. And not just ours, the last Labour government too. It's like the greatest hits of government mistakes being replayed in just 100 days.
So she wondered, who was responsible for the leaks and had they broken the conduct rules for government, the ministerial code, and specifically the bit that says major announcements on policy should be made to MPs first? The Cabinet Office Minister, Nick Thomas-Symonds, could scarcely believe his ears.
I'm sure honourable and right honourable members will forgive me if I have a degree of cynicism about the party opposite's newfound passion for parliamentary conventions, given the number of times they failed in their 14 years in office to update the House ahead of major announcements.
But Reform UK's Richard Tice argued there had been real-world consequences following on from Rachel Reeves' debt announcement to journalists in Washington last week.
It moved the markets. Bond yields went up, which means mortgages went up, which means that people's bills have gone up. I think the right thing for the government to do, Mr. Speaker, is to apologise.
Hear, hear.
Nick Thomas-Symonds didn't do that, arguing that the impact of the government's plans would be seen after the budget today. For the SNP, Brendan O'Hara was exasperated.
Can't the minister see that the government displaying such arrogant contempt for the rules only feeds that public perception that one is as bad as the other? Yeah, yeah. And rather than the change it promised, the Labour Party is really saying it's our turn now.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, wasn't in the chamber to hear those criticisms. She had, in fact, just left, having been there earlier for her regular round of questions from MPs. The government's already faced criticism over one budget change that's been widely trailed, an increase in employers' national insurance contributions, with some business groups arguing that it will hit small firms. The Liberal Democrats' Daisy Cooper put in a last-minute bid for something that might help, a change to business rates.
Small businesses are the engine of our economy, but many of them are penalised for investing in their businesses because of the broken business rate system. Will the Chancellor ensure that investment is exempted from business rates, and will she ensure that the budget tomorrow is the final budget where business rates are a permanent feature?
Rachel Reeves hinted change was on its way.
In our manifesto, we committed to have reform of our business rate system. I'll be setting out more details in the budget yesterday, tomorrow, as well as, as well as, 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 well as a business tax roadmap, because a business tax roadmap is what will give businesses certainty about the tax environment that they will be working with for the next 5 years.
Within the next 5 days, the Conservatives will finally announce their new leader. And that will mean a shake-up of the team shadowing government ministers, making this Jeremy Hunt's last appearance opposite Rachel Reeves as Shadow Chancellor. He wished her well, but rejected her accusation that the Tories hadn't made their sums add up in government to the tune of £22 billion.
We all know why she's inventing this fictitious black hole. 30 times this year, before the election, she promised not to raise tax, and tomorrow she's planning the biggest tax-raising budget in history.
Rachel Reeves didn't answer that, instead taunting Jeremy Hunt over a current row he's having with the independent financial watchdog, the OBR, over a report on the information it received from the last Conservative government, which is due to be released today.
I think it is important that we don't deny the seriousness of the situation that we face with the black hole in the public finances, combined with lashing out at independent economic institutions, suggests that he's got more in common with Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng than perhaps we thought.
The budget, trick or treat, will finally all be revealed today at 12:30.
Lisa McCarthy there, and you can hear more on events yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio.
And more on what will be in the budget, we think, in the couple of hours to come. Now at 7:11, let us turn instead to the issue of climate. More drought, more intense rain, that's the double hazard facing a growing number of countries, according to new analysis shared with the BBC, shared for another series of what's called Life at 50 Degrees, which you can get on BBC iPlayer. Behind that series is the BBC World Service population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty, who joins us in the studio this morning. More drought and a clear connection with climate change, Stephanie.
So what we're seeing, this is data from the Lancet Health and Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change, and what it shows is a really clear upward trajectory of both drought and extreme rain. So when it comes to drought, we see this slight steady increase. The data started in 1950s. It's a steady increase from the 50s to the 80s, and then a really sharp increase in drought in the amount, the percentage of the world's landmass that's affected by at least 1 month of drought. So the average was 15% in the 80s, and we're seeing around 45% now. That's tripled in just 40 years. So what's happening here is climate change is changing our rainfall patterns. These changes are consistent with what we see with the other effects of global warming. We know that it's changing the way clouds and rain work. As the ocean warms, more moisture evaporates into the air. And as the air warms, it can absorb more moisture. When that moves over land, as clouds burst, we get these short periods of intense rain and then long periods of drought afterwards. And in drought, of course, when it's hot, the soil degrades, plants die, then rain follows and it can wash away that fertile soil. So this has really profound effects on agriculture and public health.
Profound effects, particularly for those countries that find themselves with many, many more months of drought. I know one of the countries you focus on is Somalia.
Somalia has seen last year 10 months more drought than the baseline average from the 1950s, where it was one or two, and Brazil 9 months more drought last year than the 1950s, when it was about 1 month per year. So these are really profound effects. And the knock-on, of course, in a place like Brazil is for all of South America. We're already seeing the impacts on the prices of on crops like soy and corn, and those affect prices all around the world. They affect what we're paying here in the UK for food.
Stephanie Hegarty, the BBC World Service, thank you very much indeed. That series called Life at 50 Degrees. There was a first series, that'll be on iPlayer. There's a new one starting and coming up soon, and that's where you can get it, as well as, of course, listening to the World Service on BBC Sounds.
It is 7:09. Now, weekend warrior is the slightly dismissive term applied to those who hit the gym or slip on their jogging shorts only at the weekend, just once or twice a week at best. But lose the sneering tone, says the latest research. Just 1 or 2 days exercise a week, researchers found, reduced the risk of mild dementia at around the same rate as those who do more frequent exercise. Dr. Gary O'Donovan is lead researcher of the study and is based in Colombia. He told us why the findings are significant.
This study, as far as we know, is one of the very few in the world to show that being a weekend warrior offers mental health benefits. When I wrote up the study, it was the first longitudinal study to show this. Cross-sectional studies are limited. They are snapshots in time, and they have shown that weekend warriors have reduced risk of mild dementia. but ours is the first longitudinal study, or it was when I wrote it. I've recently seen another study from UK Biobank showing much the same thing. So that's great news. Our data from Mexico and data from the UK show that whether you're a weekend warrior exercising once or twice a week, or you exercise more often, you get much the same reduction in the risk of dementia.
Well, Devi Sridhar is Professor of Global Public Health at the University of Edinburgh and a qualified personal trainer and the author of the soon-to-be-released book, How Not to Die, brackets, too soon. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you find this interesting, this research?
Absolutely. It's the first study, I think, as he says, to show that weekend warriors, meaning people who only have time to exercise on the weekends because of their work or caring responsibilities, still see significant benefits of exercise to their minds and to delaying dementia.
There's two things, aren't there? There's this question of frequency, which is perhaps the sort of the top line, the weekend warrior stuff. But critically, is this link between physical exercise and mental health?
Completely. I think we've known for a long time about the evidence of physical activity for your body, right? So we think about, you know, muscles and, you know, staying cardio work to keep your heart healthy. But actually, we're now seeing research from the mental side, including delaying dementia, but also depression, and as a really effective intervention for depression. And so there's a chemical reason for this. I don't know if you want me to go into it, but there is a real cellular basis for why muscles and the brain have crosstalk over how they actually improve how we feel and how we age.
Well, I mean, I'm actually fascinated. I mean, whether we know enough about the brain and about dementia to know why there is this relationship between physical exercise and brain health.
Well, I think at the simplest basis, when muscles contract, they secrete chemicals into the bloodstream. Among these chemicals are myokines, and these have been referred to as hope molecules, but they're basically small proteins which travel to the brain through the blood, and they act as an important way of protecting our brain matter from the negative effects of aging, and so actually keeping that matter in our brain. And so I think when we look at the impact of, you know, our muscular movements, you can almost picture, you know, it moving up to your brain and having a protective impact. And so I think that's why we're seeing more of these studies at a population level, reinforced by cellular studies, where actually they're looking at these, you know, different proteins, neurotransmitters such as dopamine, noradrenaline, serotonin, and the impact that actually exercise has on your brain matter.
And the overall message is that something is a lot better than nothing. That, yes, all right, you know, three or four times a week might be optimum, but something, getting out there and doing something, is going to be a lot better.
Completely. And we're seeing more studies like this. For example, there's the idea of 10,000 steps a day, that you have to get 10,000 steps a day to stay fit. But actually, there was a study out last year showing 5,000 steps was sufficient to get the bulk of the benefit of movement. And that benefit was higher the older that you started this and did it. So it's never too late to start moving. You don't need to think of yourself as an athlete or sporty. It doesn't matter if you think, oh, perhaps I'm not the healthiest because of my age or because of my diet or alcohol intake. Just exercise itself has a huge benefit in terms of living longer. I'd say it's the number one most effective intervention you can do if you want to stay fit and healthy and independent as you get older and out of, you know, depending on others for your daily living.
And when people say to you, I mean, either as a professor of global public health or as a qualified personal trainer, you know, how much should I do? Is there too much? Is there too little? What is your answer?
Well, I think it depends on how it fits with your week. There's some people who have incredibly busy jobs who don't want to get up at 6 a.m. because it's more important they sleep or that they actually recover from their work week. There are others who actually have time in their day to walk to work and back or go for a jog at lunchtime. So I think, you know, you have to look at, you know, individually or in your, you know, life, your family, what works for you. And actually, don't feel guilty if you're not up at 6 a.m. like your colleagues in the gym. If that doesn't work for you, that's all right. Just get moving on the weekend. Something's better than nothing. And don't think of yourself as, do I have a six pack? Do I have visible muscles? Kind of the Instagram influencer model. Just be like, can I move? Does my body do what I want it to do? And if not, how do I get a bit more exercise in? One more day, one more walk. Because even a 10-minute walk will do you so much good compared to being sedentary the whole day. So kind of lowering that bar to something that fits within your life.
Devi Sridhar, thanks so much.
It's now 7:03. Radio 4's celebration of a legendary writer continues this weekend.
Dickensian on BBC Radio 4.
Brand new drama.
Your book.
is it a love story?
A Charles Dickens novel as relevant today as the day it was written.
It is not a love story, or I shouldn't be reading it. It's more about money than anything else.
A tale of the haves and have-nots, greed and intrigue.
This man's name was John Harmon.
Do you call it murder?
I do call it murder, sir.
Dickensian, Our Mutual Friend, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds on Sunday afternoon at 3.
It has just gone 2 minutes to seven. Let's get the weather from Matt Taylor.
Thank you very much, Johnny. Very good morning to you all. High pressure in charge across the UK today. Keeps things largely dry, but as we've seen through recent days, because of the position of high pressure, we've been dragging a lot of moisture off the Atlantic, plenty of cloud, and this morning one or two spots of drizzle and light rain here or there. Let's start in England and Wales. The cloud is thick enough for a little light drizzle for one or two, especially over the hills, but for the vast majority, dry day ahead. Large amounts of cloud like we've seen through recent days, but optimistic there'll be a few brighter breaks, a bit of sunshine coming through right from the start of the day across some central and eastern areas, but always best favoured for the longer spells of sunshine, really southern and eastern parts of England. For Northern Ireland, cloudy this morning, but we should start to see that cloud thin and break and a bit more in the way of sunshine develop as you go through into the afternoon. All should see a few sunny spells at the very least, and it should stay dry. As for Scotland, southern areas, we start with lots of cloud, some light rain or drizzle here at the moment, but it will brighten up to sunny spells for the afternoon. Central and northern Scotland, a lovely sunny start for the vast majority, but we're already starting to see clouds spill into the Hebrides. That could produce a few spots of rain this morning, and then later Orkney and Shetland will see some outbreaks of rain or drizzle to take us through the afternoon. North of Scotland today, temperatures around 11 to 13 degrees. Rest of the UK still well above average for the end of October, around 13 to 16 degrees. Into tonight, where you've got some clear skies. This is eastern Scotland, central and eastern England as well. We could see temperatures dip down to around 5 to 8 degrees. Most another mild night, 8 to 12 Celsius, large amounts of cloud. And tomorrow, whilst many will be dry, fairly cloudy at times, far north and northwest of Scotland, we'll see some outbreaks of rain and strengthening winds.
Matt, thank you. You're listening to Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday the 30th of October. The headlines this morning, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves will say today's budget, one of the largest tax raises in living memory, will put more pounds in people's pockets and grow the economy. BBC News has been told the most senior government figures were aware in the past few weeks that the Southport suspect could be facing further charges. The independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, Jonathan Hall, says rules around what information can be made public should now be looked at.
I've recently written to the Law Commission, who are consulting on the law of contempt of court, which is often the thing that stops information coming out in the mainstream media, to say, I think that it's important for trust and public confidence that more information is made available.
That interview will run at 10 to 8. And President Biden has denied referring to Donald Trump supporters as floating garbage.
Also coming up in the hour to come, we'll hear the activists chasing down final votes in the American presidential election. And the goal was never there.
No band has made teenage angst sound more glorious or sadness more ecstatic than The Cure.
Yes, get your red lipstick out and start backcombing your hair. The Cure are releasing new music more than two decades after their last album. A fan will celebrate with us. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will deliver what could be one of the biggest tax-raising budgets in a generation this afternoon, with a pledge to put more pounds in people's pockets and grow the economy. Ms Reeves is expected to say her priority is to invest, 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 but she'll warn that there are no shortcuts to restoring economic stability. A rise in the minimum wage by nearly 7% is among the measures. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
For the first time in 14 years, a Labour Chancellor will hold the famous red box outside number 11. Immediately, it's expected this budget will be one of the largest tax raises in living memory, anchored by a £20 billion per year rise in employers' national insurance, but more on capital gains tax, inheritance tax, and from a prolonged freeze in income tax thresholds. The need to raise already high taxes even higher is driven by a strict new self-imposed constraint, never to borrow, to fund day-to-day public spending. This is designed to ensure tranquility in the markets and low interest rates. There are risks here about the burden being shouldered by businesses, especially small ones. given the rising costs of the minimum wage and workers' rights legislation. There are some fears that rising funding will simply get swallowed up by higher wages and not more productive, more effective public services. The Chancellor is making a post-election judgment that the public prioritises getting public services running effectively and will back an emergency injection funded by higher taxes.
The Chancellor is expected to present her budget as an attempt to rebuild Britain. Here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
This will be a big budget, big tax rises, big borrowing, big spending, big historically. A budget's never been delivered by a woman before. And big politically. It'll set the political landscape for years. Don't be surprised later by the lack of surprises. Loads of it, from tax rises to borrowing more and spending more on the NHS and schools in England, has been talked up, or at least not talked down. The Conservative leader Rishi Sunak is criticising the prospect of a hike in employer national insurance. The Liberal Democrats will focus on social care. Expect a lot of talk from Rachel Reeves about what she will call choices, a budget of a scale, it will be claimed, that matches the scale of the task. Code for the country's in a mess, and they think it's going to cost a lot to fix it. The extent to which it is, and whether billions of pounds more of your money and borrowed money are the solution, are the questions for debate.
BBC News has been told that the most senior figures in government became aware in the past few weeks that there could be further charges against the 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July. Axel Rudakabana is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. Both Conservative leadership candidates said the government had questions to answer about the new charges. Here's our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
To charge a suspect under the Biological Weapons Act, the Crown Prosecution Service has to obtain consent from the government's law officers, the Attorney General or Solicitor General. The BBC's been told that in this case, consent was requested in recent weeks and granted within days. A spokesperson for Sir Keir Starmer said the charging decision and its timing were a matter for the CPS, and it was not correct to say the government had been involved in withholding facts from the public. After the new charges were announced, the Conservative leadership candidate Robert Jenrick asked why the government was not being more honest and transparent with the public. His rival, Kemi Badenoch, said there were serious questions to be asked in Parliament. The police have reiterated that the attack is not being treated as a terrorist incident. Authorities are warning that speculating about what possible motivation there might have been could lead to the collapse of the court case.
The independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, Jonathan Hall KC, has told this programme that he supports more information being made available when incidents happen, but he isn't surprised that the police are releasing it in stages.
The nature of these sorts of events is that an attack takes place, the police will rush the scene, they will carry out a series of raids, they will sweep up devices which are often the sort of golden source of evidence to see whether or not there's a terrorist cause or not, or whether other offences are being committed. And that takes a bit of time to analyse because phones are very large these days, they're often encrypted. And in terms of looking at the substances, that will take a bit of examination at laboratories.
And you can hear the full interview with Jonathan Hall at 10 to 8. President Biden is facing criticism after appearing to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage. His comments have overshadowed a rally by his vice president, Kamala Harris, in what was billed as her final big pitch in the US election. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
As Kamala Harris was addressing a huge crowd outside the White House, describing Donald Trump as a petty dictator who wants to imprison people who disagree with him, President Biden was inside the White House giving an interview in which he appeared to denigrate Mr. Trump's supporters as garbage, apparently insulting tens of millions of Americans less than a week before the election. Mr. Biden was condemning the remarks that were made by a comedian at a Trump rally on Sunday who called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage when he said,
"The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization of Latinos is unconscionable and it's un-American."
On social media, Joe Biden tried to undo the damage by saying he was talking about the hateful rhetoric spewed by the one single Trump supporter who made the remark. And the White House issued a statement saying the president was not denouncing Trump supporters, plural, But these fine grammatical differences will quickly get lost in the heat of a red-hot election campaign.
The US has asked Israel to explain what an official described as a horrifying strike in northern Gaza. At least 93 Palestinians were killed or are missing after the attack on a residential building in Beit Lahir. The Israeli military has said it's looking into reports that civilians were harmed in an area it described as an active combat zone. Officials in eastern Spain say that a number of bodies have been found after torrential rain triggered flash floods in the Valencia region. Earlier, it was reported that at least 7 people were missing. Spanish media have reported that there was more than a month's worth of rain in a single day. A new study into the health effects of climate change suggests that almost half the Earth's land surface had at least 1 month of extreme drought last year. The annual report, published by The Lancet, found that at the same time, extreme rainfall had increased. Our population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty has more.
Since the 1980s, the area of the world's landmass affected by drought has tripled. In the 80s, 15% of the world saw drought for 1 month or more, and last year that figure was 48%. The increase has been particularly dramatic in Brazil, which saw 9 months more of drought last year compared with a baseline of the 1950s. Somalia saw 10 months more. Last year was the driest year on record. It was also one of the wettest. This analysis from the Lancet Countdown on Climate and Health found that 61% of the planet saw an increase in extreme rain in the last decade when compared with the 1960s. Many places are facing a double hazard. When intense rain follows drought, the soil is especially vulnerable, causing severe damage to agriculture and to public health.
Cumbria police say a significant fire has broken out at a BAE Systems dockyard in Barrow, where the UK's nuclear submarines are built. Officers say there's no nuclear risk, but 2 people have been taken to hospital suffering from suspected smoke inhalation.
Thank you, Lisa. It is 7:09, and in just a few hours, the waiting and the deluge of speculation will be over, as Rachel Reeves tells us her plans for the nation's finances. It has been a long time since Labour has had a chance to lift that red box, and it's the first time ever that a woman has stood in Downing Street to do so. But most people will not be so much swept away by the occasion as wondering what, after all the dire warnings of the state of the public finances, what the impact on their finances will be by the time the Chancellor has finished. To help us through that thicket, I'm joined by Claire Barrett, consumer editor at the Financial Times, and Tom McInnes, director of policy at Citizens Advice. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning, Claire. And once upon a time, this was easy, wasn't it? I mean, income tax went up or down, and you'd see that in pay slips. With income tax and individual national insurance off the table, it's going to be more complex. What impacts do you think you'll be looking for? What measures will you be looking for to measure the impact on people's payslips?
Yeah, well, first of all, with income tax, the manifesto has pledged we're not going to raise the rate of income tax. But what we are expecting to see is that the tax thresholds, the point at which your income starts to be taxed, will be frozen potentially for longer, maybe up to 2030. And people call this stealth taxes because you don't need to adjust the rate of income tax, but gradually people are pushed up into higher tax bands as their pay increases. The big good news this morning for lots of lower earning workers is that by next April, there'll be a significant increase in the minimum wage, of course, and related increases in other benefits. But if that means that more of the pay that you're getting is going to be taxed, then obviously it's a bit of a double-edged sword. The other big measure that's been widely trailed is that employers will have to pay a higher rate of national insurance for their workers. Now, technically, it doesn't break the manifesto pledge, some would argue, because it's the rate that employers pay, not employees. But nevertheless, it might not affect your payslip the month after the budget, but by the year after, there could be second order effects, like employers less likely to grant pay increases to workers, maybe becoming less generous with workers' pensions contributions, or even cutting hours that people can work, potentially cutting back the number of jobs that they want to have. So even if we don't see those tax changes immediately in a way that we can feel it in our pocket, there could still be an effect.
Tom, at Citizens Advice, you are presumably talking quite often to people who are struggling to make ends meet and looking for ways to help that happen. What are the key things that you'll be looking for?
Yeah, so we think it's a great opportunity today for the Chancellor to help out some of the people who've been particularly badly hit over the last couple of years. So we're looking in particular at private renters on low incomes who are facing high and rising costs of rent. We want the value of local housing allowance to be protected going forward. We're thinking about disabled people who make up around about half of all of our clients at Citizens Advice. Think about the value of their benefits and the eligibility. Again, we need that protected because the cost of disability has been a huge part of the cost of living crisis. We're looking for particular targeted support for low-income households going into the winter. So energy prices have just risen again. They're now higher this winter than they were last. And we think that people need targeted support to keep their homes warm over the winter, sort of in the same way that we saw a couple of years ago. There's one other thing that we've been asking for around deductions to universal credit, whereby loans made up to people on the benefit would be kind of clawed back at really high rates. We've heard that the government's going to do something on that. We'd really welcome that because that's a group that being hit quite hard by just a design flaw in the nature of the benefit. So the changes there, we'd really welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Claire, we used to talk about budget giveaways as well. There's very little talk of giveaways in this budget, but there is talk about putting pounds in people's pockets. Are you scratching your head to work out where that is?
Well, I mean, one way I can think certainly for FT readers is that maybe we won't see some of these big tax grabbing measures that have been rumoured in the last few weeks and months, and that people will think, oh, it's not as bad as it could have been, because it has driven this extraordinary surge in pre-budget behaviour, people making potentially disastrous decisions for their long-term finances, cashing in pensions, taking lump sums, selling investments, selling properties if they're a landlord, taking a decision to try and pay a lower rate of capital gains tax today in case by tomorrow it's much higher. So people have made these knee-jerk reactions, but clearly with the news this morning about the minimum wage and about reforms to benefits, there is a desire there from the Chancellor to give people, working people, as they say, something to feel better about, because there is so much bad news that has been trailed with this budget. We're braced to expect it. So if it's not as bad as we're thinking, that could really be the proverbial rabbit in the Chancellor's hat this time around.
Claire Barrett, thank you. Tom McInnes, thank you very much indeed. All will be revealed in a few hours' time.
Yeah, and more on business hopes, fears about the budget coming up at about 15 minutes time. It's now 7:15. She says America will be ruled by chaos and division if he wins. He says she's presided over soaring inflation and immigration, which is out of control. Last night, the two candidates to be the next president of the United States made their final pitches to the voters.
Kamala has embarrassed us. She doesn't have what it takes. I'm asking you to dream big again. You're going to dream big, and this is going to be a very special time. It's going to be America's new golden age. We're going to make it a golden age. It seems impossible, doesn't it?
We know who Donald Trump is. He is the person who stood at this very spot nearly 4 years ago and sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol to overturn the will of the people in a free and fair election.
Just some of what American voters heard and saw last night. Well, I've been speaking to two campaigners from different sides and different states. We brought them together to assess how they're feeling ahead of next Tuesday's vote.
Well, good morning from Cartersville, Georgia.
And good evening from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have spent my day getting ready for more canvassers and trying to get my house in order so that I can spend more time out on the field and keep a happy home at the same time.
So Debbie Speakey is a Democrat from Wisconsin. How is it feeling with 1 week to go?
So we have a sort of a saying in Wisconsin that we are so used to having elections that are razor thin that we're used to being nervous and optimistic at the same time. And somebody said today that we are nauseously optimistic because that's the way elections go here. There is a great deal of activity and a lot of excitement and a lot of work because we're worker bees at this point.
And Melanie, as a Trump supporter, is nauseously excited. A good description for you too?
No, I'm just straight up excited. I am so excited. I have been busy as well today. The back of my car is full of Trump signs, and I attended a wonderful event that was at a church. It was a prayer conference hosted by the National Faith Advisory Board. President Trump was with us, and so many people came together. Ministers from across the country were there, and we just really worshiped together. And Pastor Paula White, she interviewed President Trump about his faith and his beliefs.
Well, he hasn't got any, has he, Melanie? I mean, famously, he doesn't really believe in God. He just wants the votes of people who do.
That's not true. Donald Trump has got a strong faith. At the end of the day, Donald Trump knows who is all-powerful. He knows that God is with him. And yesterday, as evidenced by the strong, powerful prayers that were covering him, you could see those in the room were so, so thankful that they could be there and be a part of that.
How does that make you feel, Debbie, listening in Wisconsin?
So she sees a different Donald Trump than we see, the Democrats here in Wisconsin see. We see the Donald Trump that was at the Madison Square Gardens on Sunday, who was sort of the I am your retribution Donald Trump, and talking about enemies within and America being a dumping ground. And we prefer the voice we hear and the person we see in Kamala Harris, who has been a woman of faith, you know, all of her life. And she speaks to us of freedom for all of us instead of, you know, control by the few. And we talk about living our own lives, loving whom we love, and being able to rule our own families and keeping the government out of our bedrooms, frankly. I happen to be a person of strong faith. I don't happen to be a Christian, but I respect all faiths. And that is one area where many of us actually are very concerned about the United States becoming a theocracy, which it was never intended to be. That rolls out in things like a woman's freedom to control her own body, which is, as you probably know, your audience must know, that it's a major issue in this election.
And Melanie, is abortion the key issue for you?
No. And the reason it's not is because no matter how you feel about the abortion issue, you are feeling the sting of the economy. You are feeling the sting of the border crisis. Both in Kamala Harris was put in charge of the border. We've seen time and time again that the border crisis is directly tied to problems with our economy. We see law enforcement having to deal with issues of illegal immigrants coming into this country.
Let's get Debbie to reply. Debbie?
So, first of all, border crossings are down from where they had been. And Kamala Harris said that she would sign and was willing to go forward with the bipartisan border bill that was considered the toughest border bill in decades.
It is the economy. Debbie, if I may, just briefly, it is the economy and it is the border issue, which explains why this election is so tight, though, isn't it?
I think that you are right on that one. Somehow there's this feeling that the Democrats are weak on the border. And when you hear Trump talking about, you know, America's an occupied country and immigrants poison the blood of America, and on day one, we're going to have mass deportations, that is alarming to most Americans.
Melanie, the warning that came from Kamala Harris in her final rally was what she called an America ruled by chaos and division. Does that not frighten you?
Not one bit. That is absolutely political rhetoric coming from that campaign that has absolutely nothing to do with reality.
He has promised to be the president of retribution, and his former generals and his chief of staff and people that have worked with him said he's a danger to America. Many of us are saying, and it is one of our sayings, we are not going back. We are just not going back.
Debbie Patel, for the Democrats in Wisconsin. Melanie Collier, for the Republicans in Georgia. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, what was charming and striking is before we recorded that, they chatted very amiably
with each other.
Such a relief, isn't it? It really is. There is still chat between political enemies. It is 22 minutes past seven. Now, it sells more clothes than anyone in the UK. So what can the retailer Next tell us about how shoppers are feeling ahead of the budget? Sean Farrington has some new detail from the company.
Yeah, sales up at Next faster than the business expected between August and October. So 7.6% on last year. And partly because of that, they now expect profits to pass £1 billion this year. Richard Hyman is retail industry analyst. Morning, Richard. The confidence of Next shoppers doesn't appear to be dented.
It doesn't. These are really tremendous results, outperforming the market very comfortably. And as usual, Next is a bit of an outlier. I think it doesn't tell us much about other companies, and it doesn't necessarily tell us that much about other shoppers. Next delivers the goods in a way that most other retailers can only dream about. They are tremendous results, and to make £1 billion profit is really an incredible milestone.
Interesting bit of detail in the mix here. It says that it thinks some of the sales at the business might have happened. That may well have happened in the run-up to Christmas. Actually, might have already happened. Customers doing their spending. Is that weather-related, doing that spending before the budget? Is it budget-related? What's going on?
Well, I think there's certainly a lot of nervousness around the budget. And, you know, the new government is trying to manage people's expectations mainly down. So there may be a bit of that. But I think that retail in general and shopping has become much, much more volatile than it's ever been before. And it's much, much harder to read patterns. Weather being very unpredictable has always been tough. But all sorts of geopolitical things happening, change sentiment, change patterns. And of course, the cost of living crisis means that people are having to think much more about what they're spending and where they're spending it.
Richard, thank you. Richard Hyman, retail industry analyst. Did you get your winter coat earlier than you previously thought? Because the colder weather coming sooner, that may be impacting those sales. Booming at Next.
I need one. 25 minutes past seven. Thanks, Sean. Let the train take the strain. It's hard to believe there was a time when that was considered a catchy advertising slogan, not least if, like commuter Matt Whitworth, who's been lobbying the mayor of Greater Manchester, you're unlucky enough to rely on Northern trains.
So this morning, woke up at 6 a.m, checked the train times, and the first train's at 8 a.m. My shift starts at 8 a.m, so it means I'm not going to be able to get to work on time, so I took the decision to work from home. The notice that you get for when they cancel the train as well is really short. So last night they were all running. This morning they've all been, the first two have been cancelled, which means nobody can get to work. I also find the way the ticketing works is anti-consumerist, in that if you want a refund, they take £5 out. The ticket's only £7.70 return. So every time they cancel a train, I just get £2.20 back rather than the full fare. It's expensive and unreliable, ultimately.
Matt speaks for many people who try to use Northern trains. They cancelled or part cancelled 51,204 trains in the last year alone. Listening to that, Andy Burnham, who is, of course, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, and today chairs something called the Rail North Committee. Morning to you, Mr. Burnham. What on earth can you do about it?
Good morning. I don't know about let the train take the strain, Nick. For people in the north of England, it's let the train create the strain and the stress and the havoc and the disruption actually to people's daily lives, and you've just heard that very eloquently expressed. What can we do about it? Well, we have called an emergency meeting of the Rail North Committee. This half-term week, we've seen over 1,000 cancellations across the Northern network. And it's just not fair, is it? Because that's ruining people's half-term plans. But if there's just one thing, Nick, that kind of tells you what level of seriousness this needs to be dealt with by a government committed to growth. Last Sunday, we had do not travel notices issued for English cities between Manchester and Stoke, Manchester and Chester. I mean, that's embarrassing, is it not? That I think, brings the UK's northern travel system into real disrepute. And it has to be addressed if we're going to get growth happening everywhere.
Well, Labour used to say nationalise the trains, but they've been nationalised. Northern Trains is run by the government. So is there anything you're expecting from the Chancellor today in the budget that might cheer you up and cheer commuters like Matt up a bit?
Well, indeed, and they did improve. You might remember me coming on your programme, Nick, a few years ago when it was run by a private operator and we had similar problems, and it did improve. But I'm not going to call out this operator because it's in the public sector. It's got really poor again. I guess in their defence, they would say that the biggest reason for this is the expiry of a rest day working agreement back in the summer, and things have gone seriously downhill since then.
But the Transport Secretary gave a huge pay rise to the rail unions and didn't get anything back in return for it, didn't she?
This is a separate issue, and it is an issue that particularly harms the rail industry west of the Pennines in your part of the world and mine. And we have to have it resolved because it means we've got a part-time railway at this moment in time, Nick. You know Manchester is experiencing higher growth than the UK average right now. The city is powering ahead on so many fronts. But the rail industry is dragging us backwards. It's damaging growth. It's hitting businesses. And it does have to become a top order issue for a government committed to growth. We do need to work with the government coming out of this emergency meeting today to get a rescue plan in place so that people can trust the trains and get to work.
Quick last one on buses, because that is something you have made a hallmark of your time as Mayor of Greater Manchester, a £2 cap for bus fares across Greater Manchester. But the government have just put it up to £3. That creates a few problems for you, doesn't it?
Well, we were never part of the national cap that the last government introduced. We are in a different position to the rest of England outside of London in that I have taken the decision to put buses back under public control, and we will complete that re-regulation exercise on the 5th of January next year. So we're in control of our fare box, Nick. And what that means is if people use the B network, I can recycle the profits back into the B network and into lower fares, rather than them going out to profits to private operators. So we've got a system now that works on the London principle, and that's why London has traditionally had lower fares. So obviously I've had to look at my plans given the announcement, but we're in the middle of this journey. We want a low fare, high patronage public transport system like the one in London, which has brought higher productivity and higher growth to London. Greater Manchester is on that journey, and obviously we're not going to change our plan at this moment in time, but we do need to put an appeal out to our residents to please use the B network. The more that people use it, the more that we'll be able to keep those low fares and keep the £2 cap in place for as long as possible.
Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester, thanks for joining us.
It is just gone 7:30. Good news for Welsh football. Here's Mike with the sport.
Yes, absolutely, Johnny. Shall we start with that big collective sigh of relief in Cardiff?
Wales are through to the playoff final. An absolutely exhausting but glorious evening in Cardiff. More cracks are appearing in that glass ceiling. They are two steps away from a first ever major tournament.
I think I've just scored the most important goal of my career to get the job done and see how much it means to all of the girls, but also how much it means to everybody in this stadium. It's incredible.
Yes, quite the party it sounds in Cardiff last night after Wales made it through to the playoff final for next summer's Women's European Championship by the skin of their teeth. Midfielder Kerry Holland, who you heard from just there, scored a dramatic extra time winner over Slovakia to keep their dreams of reaching a first major tournament alive. Well, BBC Sports' Katie Gornall joins us now. Katie, this is big for Wales, isn't it? They stand on the brink of history.
They do, Mike, yes. And you can just tell how much it would mean to them if they were able to reach a major tournament for the first time, because they know just what a transformative effect on women's football that could have in the country. And they've come so close recently, haven't they? They narrowly missed out on a place at Euro 2022 on away goals scored. They were beaten in extra time in a playoff final for the 2023 World Cup. So, you know, they've been steadily building momentum under Rhiann Wilkinson. They've got a great blend right now of youth and experience, and they will hope this is their time and they can overcome Ireland in a two-legged playoff to reach their first major tournament.
Elsewhere last night, Northern Ireland also scored an extra time winner to beat Croatia in Belfast. They'll play Norway in the playoff final. Scotland will face Finland after they cruised past Hungary yesterday. As for England, Katie, you were in Coventry last night, weren't you, to watch them beat South Africa 2-1 in a friendly, but sounds like the performance was a little underwhelming.
Yeah, I think far from convincing, you would say. You know, let's not forget, they're playing South Africa. That's a team ranked 48 places below them. England would have been expected to win and win well in that game. You know, there were positives on the one hand. You know, it's a friendly. You'd rather make your mistakes now than in 8-9 months' time in Switzerland. The young players, I thought, performed really well. Grace Clinton from Manchester United, she was excellent. She scored England's second goal and had an impact defensively as well. But, you know, there were some of the same old problems for England, particularly in defence. We saw some individual errors as well. And that has to be a concern for Serena Wiegmann. It was something she was asked about after the game. And she said, look, she's aware that England was sloppy. She doesn't have to have all the answers now, but they are really going to have to iron these things out. And they've got USA in a friendly in November. So if they don't, they're going to be struggling against the Olympic champions.
All right, Katie Gornall, got to leave it there. A reminder that the Women's Euros take place in Switzerland next summer. And finally, a reminder that our sporting guest this morning is the two-time Grand National winning jockey Davy Russell. The Irishman, who's also won the Cheltenham Gold Cup, has been talking to me about his life in racing and some of the challenges faced by jockeys, such as his strategy for making the weight for big races.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks, Mike. There, it's 27 minutes past eight, and we are going to take a quick look at the weather now. It's going to be areas of mist and fog will lift and clear from England and Wales this morning. It'll be a largely dry day with variable cloud and sunny spells. Light rain will move into northern Scotland later.
Mike, we're looking forward to that interview with Davy Russell about his diet, his little cube of chocolate, we say. Keeps it going. That later. We're also looking forward, of course, to the Moral Maze. Michael Burke's here with in the studio. Michael, what can you tell us about it tonight?
Well, of course, Nick. Yeah. Daniel Dowling Brooks is double-barrelled in more than name. He's the armed kidnapper picked up in a Bentley after being released early, along with 1,100 other criminals last week, to clear space in our overcrowded prisons. The one who chortled as he toasted Keir Starmer for his premature freedom. It all focuses attention on who prison's for and what it's for. Punishment, deterrence, public protection or rehabilitation. We lock up proportionally more people than anywhere else in Europe, the inadequate as well as the wicked. Too many? Too few. Would other measures work better, be cheaper? Bang 'em up or let 'em out. The Moral Maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Look forward to that, Michael. Thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4, Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. At 25 to 8, Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Chancellor will deliver the first Labour budget for 14 years this afternoon with a pledge to put more pounds in people's pockets despite big tax increases. Rachel Reeves is expected to say that she'll prioritise investment, but she'll warn that there are no shortcuts to restoring economic stability. The BBC has been told that senior government figures became aware in the past few weeks that there could be further charges against the 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July. Axel Rudakabana is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. The United States has asked Israel to explain a strike in northern Gaza that left more than 90 Palestinians missing or dead. Washington has also warned its ally that it's not doing enough to address the humanitarian crisis 2 weeks into a 30-day deadline. Israel's military has said it's looking into reports that civilians were harmed. President Biden has been criticised for appearing to refer to Donald Trump supporters as garbage. Mr. Biden said he'd been referring to remarks made by a comedian at a Trump rally who described Puerto Rico as an island of floating garbage. According to a new study looking at the health effects of climate change, almost half the Earth's land surface had at least 1 month of extreme drought last year. The annual report, published by The Lancet, suggests that at the same time, extreme rainfall had increased. The rise in drought has been particularly severe in South America, the Middle East and the Horn of Africa, posing a risk to food security and sanitation. Emergency services are tackling a significant fire at the BAE shipyard in Barrow-in-Furness, where nuclear submarines are built. Police say there's no nuclear risk, but two people have been taken to hospital, suffering from suspected smoke inhalation. People in the area have been urged to stay indoors and to keep their windows and doors shut.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. 23 minutes to 8. A perfect storm for business. That is how the Institute of Directors have described the combination of higher taxes, which the Chancellor will confirm when she stands up to deliver her budget in 5 hours' time, together with the higher minimum wage she announced yesterday and the new rights for workers the government unveiled some weeks ago. But will business leaders be cheered up by what they hear from Rachel Reeves today about investment and about planning reform and greater certainty for them? Well, let's talk to two chief executives indeed. Mark Reynolds, chief executive of the Mace Group, which employs more than 7,000 people, and Andrew Selly, CEO of Bidfood. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin, Andrew, with the cost of workers, the minimum wage going up and substantially going up for younger workers, and what we now know is an increase in national insurance for businesses. How much of a difficulty is that when it comes to hiring new workers?
I think the difficulty is the increased cost across the whole supply chain. So that increase in minimum wage is going to increase costs in agriculture, increase costs in manufacturing, increase costs in supply chain, and obviously increase costs in retail and hospitality. So whilst we recognise there's a long-term benefit of increasing national living wage because there's more money coming into the economy, more consumption, the immediate impact is simply higher costs. And obviously there's a concern around viability of small and medium-sized businesses, which make up the majority of the food supply chain.
A concern around viability is polite code for saying businesses will go bust, isn't it?
Yeah.
Simple as that. Is that your fear, Mark, or does it affect you rather differently, given that you're running a big construction company and expecting a share of some of that investment, I suspect?
Yeah, in fairness, the construction sector across the board is one of the highest paid in the country. So, you know, we are the second best paid industry in the country. So we don't have quite the same challenges as hospitality and those other sectors like agriculture. So whilst it is at the lower end sometimes difficult, generally across the sector, it's not too much of a problem for us.
And Andrew, is it a relief to hear that the Chancellor's going to outline what she calls a tax roadmap for business? In other words, if you take a hit today, but you get some greater certainty about the future, will that help?
Yeah, I think all we've heard is obviously the bad news being dripped. I mean, we'd like to see some positivity within that as well. You know, there are areas where, you know, business rates relief, we would like to see that maintained. The sort of capital allowances, tax incentives we'd like to see maintained, because we need some encouragement to invest for the future and to attract foreign investment as well.
Mark, she says, Rachel Reeves, ahead of her budget, that it's all about, as she puts it, invest, invest, invest. That must give you some hope that there'll be some big construction projects that you can get a share of.
Yeah, I would add two words to that, at pace. We need to move quickly because we're missing this productivity. When talks about productivity, we're really missing an opportunity for the country to achieve the growth that is being aspired to. So whilst we need to do that, you know, projects have been stalled. There is a real opportunity to release land at pace for new homes, and that should be done really through the local authorities. And
when you say at
them.
Pace, just to be clear, you mean the planning system's got to move quicker?
It's not just the planning system, it's actually funding of those projects. So when we decide to invest, let's move those projects forward and do them more quickly. So planning is clearly a constraint, but also there's the decision-making process that actually needs. I'm a huge fan of devolution. So, you know, I think empowering the local authorities, people like through the Northern Powers Partnership to really take a hold of that can help. And, you know, the work that we've been doing through the Construction Leadership Council on productivity, showing that actually quicker decisions, working more collaboratively with industry and government, we can move things forward more quickly.
Mark Reynolds, Chief Executive of the Mace Group, Andrew Selly of Bidfood, thank you for joining us. Of course, you can listen live
to the budget on BBC News, and in particular with our friends on The World at One.
Indeed, it is 19 minutes to 8. It is time to dust off your blackest clothes and dig out your palest makeup. The Cure are back with a new song, and the band, often labelled rather lazily as goth rock, I've just done it myself, have an album swift to follow. The song Alone can be heard on Marianne Hobbs's show on Radio 6 Music tomorrow. The album is the first since 4/13 Dream, which was released back in 2008 and did not do terribly well. Cure fan and journalist Hadley Freeman tells us what the band, their music and the new release means to her.
Fans of the greatest goth band in the world, The Cure, are not known for displays of excitement. Gloom is generally seen as our comfort zone. But this week, the excitement is truly unleashed. The smudged eyeliner a little more sparkly, because this week is the week many of us feared would never happen. The Cure are releasing their latest album, Songs of a Lost World, and the critics are unanimous. It is a masterpiece. Every time you kiss me, I could cry, she said. Don't tell me how. Formed in 1978 by a bunch of school friends from West Sussex, no band has made teenage angst sound more glorious or sadness more ecstatic than The Cure. The girl was never there. It's always the same. I'm running towards nothing again and again and again and again. The frontman and founder of the group, Robert Smith, sings on The Forest, which manages to be gorgeous and yet also deeply relatable for any 16-year-old waiting at a bus stop for their date. The girl was never there. It's always the same. I'm running towards nothing. Again and again and again and again and again. And yet, unlike so many things we love when we're 16, The Cure has aged wonderfully well. I bought my first Cure album in 1990 when I was 12. In fact, it was the first pop album I bought with my own money, and it was Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me. I bought it after seeing the video for Just Like Heaven on MTV, and I knew I'd just heard the perfect pop song. 34 years later, I still hold to that view. Strangers, angels, dancing in the deepest oceans, to see. What I loved about Just Like Heaven then was the swoony romanticism. Now, what I love about it is how it evokes elegant decay and crumbling dreams, feelings that are even more relevant in middle age than they were in youth. This is true of all the best Cure songs, especially the gothier ones like Love Song and Disintegration. The band is best known for their cheerier hits, 1983's Love Cats, which Robert Smith wrote as a self-sabotaging joke, and 1992's Friday I'm in Love, which I absolutely hated when it came out, with its meaningless happy clappiness. I don't care if Monday's blue, Tuesday's grey and Wednesday too, Thursday I don't care about you, it's Friday I'm in love. But The Cure refused to be defined by the success of those songs. After all, their 1992 album Wish might have the dreaded Friday I'm in Love on it, but it also has the beautiful A Letter to Elise, which is everything I love about The Cure. Mysterious, mythical, majestic. Elise, believe I never wanted this. I thought this time I'd keep all of my promises. Smith's makeup is a little more cracked than it was 40 years ago, but his voice still sounds exactly the same. Everyone from electronic duo Crystal Castles to frat boy rockers Blink-182 have expressed their love for The Cure, but the band has refused to cash out, keeping their ticket prices reasonable and remaining steadfastly uninterested in celebrity. Smith has been married to his childhood sweetheart, Mary Poole, for almost 40 years, and last year serenaded her from the stage with the extraordinary love song, Plain Song, to TikTok delight. This love is a fragile thing. This love is my everything and nothing. The Cure became epic by staying totally true to who they are.
Good Lord, those tunes. Hadley Freeman there in praise of The Cure. And The Cure will play a special BBC Radio 2 in concert on October the 30th. That'll be broadcast through Joe Wiley's show on Radio 2 and BBC Sounds on Thursday, October the 31st. The show also features an interview with Robert Smith.
Coming up on this programme, with some alleging a cover-up in what we were told about the alleged Southport attacker, we'll be discussing how much information the police should make public when they're investigating crimes and hearing from the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation, Jonathan Hall. It's time now, though, for Thought for the Day at 13 minutes to 8. The speaker this morning, Professor Mona Siddiqui, academic and broadcaster at the University of Edinburgh.
Good morning. Earlier in the week on this programme, Sir Michael Parkinson's son defended the use of AI to recreate his father's voice for a new podcast series. Virtually Parkinson has been produced with the support of Sir Michael's family, and his son Mike said that he really wanted it to be clear to listeners that it is an AI iteration. Over the last few years, AI has entered our lives in leaps and bounds, but it's also brought new ethical dilemmas of how disruptive or creative it can be for our jobs, our minds, and perhaps increasingly our own sense of uniqueness as human beings. Scientists have drawn parallels between us and computer programming. But if we are more than just code, what is it that sets us apart? We think it's our emotions, flaws, our capacity for warmth, empathy, and deep connection, things that machines simply can't replicate. But if AI reflects both our intellect and our values, it may just be a matter of time before an AI system wakes up to the first sparks of not just simulating emotion, but feeling emotion. What I find intriguing is how AI is challenging the way we think we can control our own mortality. Technology already allows people to be so-called reunited with their loved ones through digital resurrections, where AI can reproduce the voice, image, and behavior of those who've died. And if we capture enough data during someone's life, we could keep them alive indefinitely after their physical brain has gone. With millions of us on social media talking about our lives every day, data capture has never been easier. The promise of a life beyond is not new, but central to the monotheistic faith and imagination. In the Quran, Adam is seduced by Iblis partly by the promise that eating from the forbidden fruit will grant him immortality. Whatever immortality means today, it reflects human desire, our ability to exercise free will, to be curious, remembered, and push boundaries. As the Indian philosopher and poet Allama Iqbal said, it is desire which tears away all the veils. As with so much of technology, the aim is to make life quicker, smarter, and easier, and all of it may be true. But as we strive for technological precision and perfection, we do risk losing control. The question we face isn't about the future potential of AI, that's a given, but rather the risks it poses to our own human uniqueness.
That was Thought for the Day with Professor Mona Siddiqui. The time now, 10 to 8.
The teenager accused of murdering three young girls in Southport over the summer has also been charged with offences under the Biological Weapons Act for possession of the poison ricin and the Terrorism Act for possessing information linked to an Al-Qaeda training manual. But what happened in Southport has not been declared a terrorist incident. The news about the extra charges has led some to complain that the police have withheld information unnecessarily. Conservative Party leadership candidate Robert Jenrick has spoken of his serious concern and that any suggestion of a cover-up will damage public trust. That was echoed by his rival Kemi Badenoch. Jonathan Hall KC is the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. I asked him why Axel Rudakubana is being charged under the Terrorism Act, yet this is not being declared a terrorist incident.
I think these days the difference between whether an attack is a terrorist attack or not a terrorist attack is often wafer thin. That's just because of the profile of people who are now involved in attacks, by which I mean lone actors. In the old days, it was much simpler to work out that someone, when they carried out an attack, were doing it to advance a cause. That's the technical the language. You've got to advance an ideological or political, religious or racial cause. And in the past, it was reasonably clear because people were carrying out terrorist attacks in order to prove to other people why they were doing it. So they might release a martyrdom video, or the police, when they carry out the investigation, might be able to see that they are strongly associated with a group. A manifesto might be found on a device. It might turn out that they're deeply immersed in a particular sort of propaganda, and that would allow the police and ultimately a prosecutor to put something in front of a jury or a judge and say, you can be sure beyond reasonable doubt that this is why this person carried out an attack. These days, that's just not so much the case. And I mean, the police have been saying, I think rightly, and certainly my experience as well, for years, look, we often have people, and I'm not talking about this case in particular, who are acting on their own. When we look at their devices, they've got either nothing in terms of ideological material. They certainly don't release a manifesto. They're not part of any group. And if they do have material on their devices, sometimes it turns out that it's lots of different sorts of material. So it's quite hard to say which flavour of ideology they might be trying to pursue. Plus, one often finds in cases a degree of mental health or neurodiversity and a sense that people are acting out a personal grievance rather than crucially trying to advance a cause.
So is it a line that needs to be crossed, or is it a series of lines that need to be crossed for the decision to be made?
It's a single line.
Right.
Are they advancing a cause? But it's a question of evidence. There's no presumption. You might say to yourself, why on earth would someone carry out a mass casualty attack? Surely the only reason for doing an attack on strangers and killing people is to advance a terrorist cause. But I mean, we know, don't we, from the USA, where there are these terrible school massacres the whole time. Those don't seem to be terrorist attacks at all. These are often quite young people who are trying to emulate previous attacks, maybe to get notoriety, maybe because they've got a grievance against their school. But it doesn't follow, I'm afraid, that because someone has carried out a big attack, that they therefore must be doing advancing a cause. But that's the key issue. Can the prosecutors show that a person is advancing a cause when they carried out that attack? Not at some earlier stage or some later stage. When they used violence, were they doing so to advance a cause? That's the key test. And it always comes down to a question of evidence. There are cases, it sounds bizarre, but it's absolutely true, where someone has got Al-Qaeda material, someone's got IRA material, someone's got extreme right material. And sometimes all that you can really say when you look at someone's devices is this individual is fascinated with violence. It's violence that's drawing them on, or maybe a desire to copy previous attacks, but you can't say it's an ideological cause that they are pursuing.
The BBC's been told that the government or senior figures in government became aware of the possibility of new charges in this case a few weeks ago, or in the past few weeks. The suggestion has come from some that by not releasing that information, you undermine trust in the authorities, in the police and in the prosecution services. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the first point is I'm a strong supporter in more information coming out. So at the time of the original riots following the Southport attack, I was very clear that more should have been said about the identity of this individual. And in fact, I've recently written to the Law Commission, who are consulting on the law of contempt of court, which is often the thing that stops information coming out in the mainstream media, to say, I think that it's important for trust and public confidence that more information is made available. That's true about the background and identity. As to the new charges, I'm not completely surprised that things come out in stages. The nature of these sorts of events is that an attack takes place, the police will rush the scene, they will carry out a series of raids. They will sweep up devices, which are often the sort of golden source of evidence to see whether or not there's a terrorist cause or not, or whether other offences are being committed. And that takes a bit of time to analyse because phones are very large these days. They're often encrypted. And in terms of looking at the substances, that will take a bit of examination at laboratory. So I don't know personally when ministers found out about it, but I'm not surprised that things come out in stages.
The Conservative Party leadership candidate, Robert Jenrick, is asking what Sir Keir Starmer knew and when he learned it. If the government knows about police charges and about the circumstances, should they have spoken about it?
Well, I think that's a really good question. On the if question, I mean, the police and the CPS are operationally independent, and it's important that they are. And it's right that the government trust the prosecuting, the police authorities as to what might damage potential future proceedings. So I think there has to be a relationship of trust. And if the police and the CPS are saying, we really don't think that you can put any more in the public domain, I think that the government ought to be affected by that. On the other hand, I also think that the government has to be aware and will be aware that if there is an information gap, particularly in the mainstream media, then there are other voices, particularly in social media, who will try and fill it. So, I mean, I would always say to the government, and do say to the government, as I say to the police, if there is information that you can give, put it in the public domain and be really careful that you don't fall into the trap of saying we can only say zilch because there are criminal proceedings. Quite often there's a fair amount of information that can be put into the public domain, and I think I detect that the police are trying to do that. They realise now that just saying there's a charge we can't say anymore is not going to cut it these days.
Jonathan Hall, thank you very much indeed.
At 3 minutes to eight, here are some familiar sounding voices with the word on Friday's 6:30 comedy.
Dead Ringers is a topical, satirical impression show. Whatever's been in the news that week, nobody's safe.
Who can we hear in the new series? Well,
we're going to hear from Kamala Harris.
Well, you got Donald there.
Stacey Solomon.
You're probably going to hear a lot from Keir Starmer now that he's in the job.
I made it very clear that if you didn't do your maths homework, you wouldn't be going to the party.
Nigel, I don't know. He might make an appearance. It's difficult to say.
The new series of Dead Ringers, Friday night 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather from Matt Taylor.
Thank you, Johnny. Very good morning, all. Let's start in Scotland, where in the south we've got some cloud, patchy rain at the moment. That will quickly depart, and then skies will brighten, sunshine will come out. Across the rest of Scotland, though, it's a fresh but lovely start to the day. There'll be some sunshine for many. The Hebrides all quickly seeing cloud, patchy rain just squeak by this morning, and into the afternoon, Orkney and Shetland will start to see some damper conditions gradually move its way in. Northern Ireland, cloudy this morning, but increasing amounts of sunshine developing through the afternoon. Most places staying dry. As for England and Wales, the cloud is thick enough, especially on some hills, for a little light drizzle right now, but most places having a dry day today. There will be again large amounts of cloud across many parts, but already we've got some sunshine in places, especially central and eastern parts, and some of the longer spells of sunshine today will be found towards southern and eastern parts of England. Temperatures this afternoon, northern Scotland around 11 to 13 degrees, most of the UK are warm, 13 to 16 degrees, about 2 degrees above where we should be for this stage in late October. Stays mild for most tonight, although with some clear skies, eastern Scotland and central and eastern England will see temperatures dip down into mid-single figures, and there could be some mist and fog patches too.
Thanks, Matt. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday the 30th of October. The headlines. As she prepares to deliver one of the largest tax-raising budgets in living memory, the Chancellor is promising to put more pounds in people's pockets and grow the economy. BBC News has been told the most senior government figures knew in the past few weeks that the Southport murder suspect could be facing further charges. And the White House has tried to clarify remarks by President Biden after he appeared to refer to Donald Trump's supporters as floating garbage.
Coming up before 9 o'clock, as well as the budget and the US elections, 50 years on, the rumble in the jungle. Why that fight between Ali and Foreman has continued to capture the world's imagination. We'll have recommendations from you, our listeners, for spooky stories for our children's book club. And why this? A clue. It's got something to do with 2024's Tree of the Year. That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Lisa Costello.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will deliver what could be one of the biggest tax-raising budgets in a generation this afternoon, with a pledge to put more pounds in people's pockets and grow the economy. Ms Reeves is expected to say her priority is to invest, 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 but she'll warn that there are no shortcuts to restoring economic stability. A rise in the minimum wage of nearly 7% is among the measures. Here's our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
For the first time in 14 years, a Labour Chancellor will hold the famous red box outside number 11. Immediately, it's expected this budget will be one of the largest tax raises in living memory, anchored by a £20 billion per year rise in employers' national insurance, but more on capital gains tax, inheritance tax, and from a prolonged freeze in income tax thresholds. The need to raise already high taxes even higher is driven by a strict new self-imposed constraint, never to borrow, to fund day-to-day public spending. This is designed to ensure tranquility in the markets and low interest rates. The Chancellor is set to claim the findings of an independent Office for Budget Responsibility review as evidence for what she calls a black hole of £22 billion in public spending. The opposition have already claimed that the timing of this review is a political intervention by the forecaster. There are risks here about the burden being shouldered by businesses, especially small ones, given the rising costs of the minimum wage and workers' rights legislation. There are some fears that rising funding will simply get swallowed up by higher wages and not more productive, more effective public services. The Chancellor is making a post-election judgment that the public prioritises getting public services running effectively and will back an emergency injection funded by higher taxes.
Business groups have said they're concerned about the possible impact of increasing employers' national insurance contributions and the minimum wage. Andrew Selly, the chief executive of the food distribution company Bidfood, told us some companies would struggle to survive.
That increase in minimum wage is going to increase costs in agriculture, increase costs in manufacturing, increase costs in supply chain, and obviously increase costs in retail and hospitality. So whilst we recognise there's a long-term benefit of increasing national living wage because there's more money coming into the economy, more consumption, the immediate impact is simply higher costs. And obviously there's a concern around viability of small and medium-sized businesses which make up the majority of the food supply chain.
The Chancellor is expected to present her budget as an attempt to rebuild Britain. Here's our political editor, Chris Mason.
This will be a big budget, big tax rises, big borrowing, big spending, big historically. A budget's never been delivered by a woman before. And big politically. It'll set the political landscape for years. Don't be surprised later by the lack of surprises. Loads of it, from tax rises to borrowing more and spending more on the NHS and schools in England, has been talked up, or at least not talked down. The Conservative leader Rishi Sunak is criticising the prospect of a hike in employer national insurance. The Liberal Democrats will focus on social care. Expect a lot of talk from Rachel Reeves about what she will call choices, a budget of a scale, it will be claimed, that matches the scale of the task. Code for the country's in a mess, and they think it's going to cost a lot to fix it. The extent to which it is, and whether billions of pounds more of your money and borrowed money are the solution, are the questions for debate.
BBC News has been told that the most senior figures in government became aware in the past few weeks that there could be further charges against the 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July. Axel Rudakabana is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. Both Conservative leadership candidates said the government had questions to answer about the new charges. Here's our political correspondent, Hannah Miller.
To charge a suspect under the Biological Weapons Act, the Crown Prosecution Service has to obtain consent from the government's law officers, the Attorney General or Solicitor General. The BBC's been told that in this case, consent was requested in recent weeks and granted within days. A spokesperson for Sir Keir Starmer said the charging decision and its timing were a matter for the CPS, and it was not correct to say the government had been involved in withholding facts from the public. After the new charges were announced, the Conservative leadership candidate Robert Jenrick asked why the government was not being more honest and transparent with the public. His rival, Kemi Badenoch, said there were serious questions to be asked in Parliament. The police have reiterated that the attack is not being treated as a terrorist incident. Authorities are warning that speculating about what possible motivation there might have been could lead to the collapse of the court case.
President Biden is facing criticism after appearing to refer to Donald Trump's supporters as garbage. His comments have overshadowed a rally by his vice president, Kamala Harris, in what was billed as her final big pitch in the US election. Here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
As Kamala Harris was addressing a huge crowd outside the White House, describing Donald Trump as a petty dictator who wants to imprison people who disagree with him, President Biden was inside the White House giving an interview in which he appeared to denigrate Mr. Trump's supporters as garbage, apparently insulting tens of millions of Americans less than a week before the election. Mr. Biden was condemning the remarks that were made by a comedian at a Trump rally on Sunday who called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage when he said,
"The only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. His demonization is seen as unconscionable and it's un-American."
On social media, Joe Biden tried to undo the damage by saying he was talking about the hateful rhetoric spewed by the one single Trump supporter who made the remark. And the White House issued a statement saying the president was not denouncing Trump supporters, plural. But these fine grammatical differences will quickly get lost in the heat of a red-hot election campaign.
The United States has asked Israel to explain what an official described as a horrifying strike in northern Gaza. More than 90 Palestinians were killed or are missing. Washington has also warned its ally that it's not doing enough to address the humanitarian crisis 2 weeks into a 30-day deadline. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell reports.
Footage showed bodies wrapped in blankets after they were pulled from the rubble of a residential building in Beit Lahia. The State Department spokesman Matthew Miller called the strike a horrifying incident with a horrifying result and said the US had asked Israel for more information. The Israeli military has said it's looking into reports that civilians were harmed in an area it described as an active combat zone. Meanwhile, there was a fresh warning about the humanitarian situation in Gaza as Washington's deadline approaches for Israel to improve the flow of aid or face potential restrictions on US military assistance. The US ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said that pledges by Israel must be matched by action on the ground. Right now, that is not happening.
Officials in Spain say at least 13 people have died in flash flooding that was triggered by torrential rain in southern and eastern areas of the country. Emergency services have continued their rescue efforts overnight. Spanish media have reported that more than a month's worth of rain fell in a single day. Cumbria police say a significant fire has broken out at a BAE Systems dockyard in Barrow, where the UK's nuclear submarines are built. Officers say there's no nuclear risk, but two people have been taken to hospital suffering from suspected smoke inhalation. Conservationists say a project to remove stoats from Orkney has boosted threatened birds and a species of vole found only on the islands. The Orkney Native Wildlife Project started 5 years ago, as our environment correspondent Helen Briggs reports.
Stoats are common in parts of mainland Scotland, but they only started appearing in Orkney in 2010. With no natural predators, the animals quickly multiplied, threatening native wildlife. Stoats are skilled hunters, eating small mammals, birds and eggs, and there were fears for rare nesting birds and chicks. In 2019, wildlife experts were given permission to humanely trap and remove the predators, eradicating over 6,000 stoats from the islands. In a report, the RSPB says monitoring work has revealed population boosts for hen harriers, curlews, Orkney voles and other rare and threatened species in what it describes as a success story for conservation against the backdrop of a nature crisis that is pushing more of Scotland's wildlife to the brink.
Helen Briggs reporting.
Lisa, thank you. It is now 8:10. Today is the day when all the talk, all the speculation, all the uncertainty finally comes to an end. It's the day the Chancellor finally reveals how much more she'll spend, how much more she'll tax, how much more she'll borrow as she delivers the first Labour budget since 2010. The message emerging from the red box, which Rachel Reeves will hold up for the cameras outside number 11 in a couple of hours' time, will, she says, be invest, invest, invest. And intriguingly, she's also promising to put more pounds in people's pockets. This after days, weeks of verbal contortions about who exactly is and who is not counted as a working person, who therefore will be protected, who not, by Labour's manifesto promise not to increase taxes on working people. Our guides throughout this big day on radio, television, the internet and who knows where else. Chris Mason, our political editor, and Faisal Islam, our economics editor. Morning to you both. Busy day ahead. Let's begin, Chris, with the historic nature of this. Sometimes we talk things up, but I am struck by the fact that Rachel Reeves herself draws parallels with some of the great Labour governments since the war.
Yeah, politicians are often tempted, aren't they, to sketch their own place into history. And Rachel Reeves will have a go at that in her rhetoric at lunchtime alongside the announcements that we will hear. So she's going to compare her task with that of incoming Labour governments of the best part of the last century. So she'll refer back to 1945 and the rebuild of the country after the Second World War, to 1964 and Harold Wilson's promise the year before to harness the white heat of a scientific revolution. And then inevitably, for any Labour figure, a comparison with 1997, the last time that they won from opposition, referring to the rebuilding of schools and hospitals. So a nod to the history, and I think an attempt as well to articulate a sense of the scale of the challenge as she sees it, and therefore the scale of the budget she thinks is necessary to take that on.
Significant expectations to manage, Faisal, in the markets and in the business community too.
Absolutely. It's a significant change in macroeconomic strategy that we're seeing. We're seeing a sort of change in the economic story. And I think talking to top policymakers, they said the important thing for the Chancellor today is not just to land the numbers and the policies, but also to give a guide to the markets, to the private sector, as to the story, as to what they're trying to achieve. Because obviously we all, you know, still the shadow of what happened 2 years ago in the mini budget sort of looms over every Chancellor and will do for years to come. And so getting that story right, that you're trying to invest, that there, yes, there is going to be more tax and more borrowing for a purpose, is really important. And it's probably why we've had even more kind of pre-briefing than we're used to in terms of the broad brushstrokes of this. And the broad brushstrokes are that we're going to get significant extra tax rises, kind of up on the league table of the big tax rising budgets that we've seen in the past half century. That is to fund investment and an injection into the public services that they feel was the message from the general election. But that won't be funded by borrowing. So that's quite a strict, a central new rule that she will announce today. But on the other hand, the borrowing will be kept and increased for investment purposes for the long term. So that is the general picture. And the markets, you know, you have seen a creep up in the borrowing rates facing the British government. They're sort of in keeping with what we've seen across the world, and in particular in the US, where there's actually an even bigger fiscally relevant event, which is US presidential election. But because of the volatility around the world, that is why I think they do want to, the Chancellor will want to send a message to the markets that this is a sort of tough and prudent hand on the tiller, as well as the investment plans that she has.
And Chris, alongside that message of invest, 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 it's slightly tedious that we have to repeat things three times in order to emphasise that they really mean it, isn't it? But there we are. She's also, and I was really intrigued by this, promising to put money into people's pockets. Now, I thought the whole point of £40 billion spending cuts or tax rises or borrowing required is quite a lot of money be coming out of people's pockets.
Yeah, it seems to me they've latched upon this four-word phrase, protecting working people's pay slips, which is a four-word acknowledgement that employer national insurance is going up, and that when someone looks at their pay slip next month compared with this month, or the one after the budget compared with the one before, or whenever any measures kick in, there won't be any direct read across. On that broader point, by the way, Nick, that Faisal was touching on why we've heard so much in advance this time, even more so than usual, there's a sentiment that is so striking that I'm picking up, which is that a sense that a big budget is fine, a surprise budget is fine, but a big and surprising budget is not fine, because look what happened 2 years ago, all hell broke loose, and hence that rolling of the pitch, as politicians like to describe it, of basically, in one way or another, announcing the vast majority of it in advance.
Let's just analyse those four words, Faisal, can we? Because there are plenty of tax rises, real changes to people's incomes, that never, in quotes, show up on your payslip, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking about an economic concept called incidence, actually, even if we it's a bit too early for economics lectures right now. But yeah, when you levy a tax, there is a place that it hits first, but then it filters across the economy. That's the basic thing that you're describing there. And I think if you flip back, what we're getting here is an attempt to sort of unpick what were very carefully worded manifesto promises. Now, if you reread those, you can see that they were designed to create a defence in precisely this situation. So it does raise the question as to whether they had anticipated that they'd want this room for manoeuvre. That does appear to be the case. You know, when in 2002, which is one of the budgets, I think I'm drawing a parallel here, where national insurance went up to fund the NHS, there was no promise at all on national insurance. So that was, you know, clearly not a breach of the manifesto. But it's going to be argued incessantly today, those words in the manifesto about working people and national insurance. You've also,
spell it out to people, Faisal, that because there will be a tax rise for businesses in national insurance, the government's critics will say, well, hold on, workers will pay it in the end because they'll get paid less because the businesses will have lower profits. They'll try and claim that that isn't really a breach of the promise at all.
That's what they're going to claim. They'll also claim, I mean, I interviewed Rachel Reeves about the tax thresholds, this famous fiscal drag, so you carry on freezing and you more people kind of seep into higher tax rates. I did ask her about that during the election campaign, and she said she couldn't rule it out, that there are no promises on that. But I think the general picture, when you get tens of billions of pounds worth of tax rises, some of that, of course, will filter across the economy and will affect people. But I think they're going to try and depict all of this as a tax hike on businesses and on wealth in order to fund an injection into public services.
Now, Chris, that is what this matters, of course, because there are plenty of people who will be counting pennies and pounds in businesses, in households, and how it affects them. But it matters because it shapes the national conversation, what we sometimes call politics, but it's much bigger than that, isn't it? The conversation about how we're doing as a country and whether this government is mending faults created by the last one or coming up with a whole series of excuses, on the other hand, for breaking its own promises.
Completely that, on both of those scores. So yes, that manifesto was carefully worded, but also Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves and plenty of others told me and you and anyone else who would listen throughout the election campaign that they were not planning to raise a whole load of taxes beyond the narrow bunch of them that they said that they had. And we had the Institute for Fiscal Studies saying during the campaign that there was a conspiracy of silence and the main parties were hiding and ducking their real choices in taxes and spending. And here we are on budget day. But yeah, there is that bigger picture point, isn't there, about where our politics is. This sketching out the landscape for the months and years to come. A sense, as one figure put it to me last night, that the shadow boxing of the months immediately after the election are over. Not least because, yes, you have the budget today, but by Saturday lunchtime, you also have a new Conservative leader. So in both policies and personalities, the politics and, yes, that wider national conversation for the coming years is going to take shape in the next 3 or 4 days.
Chris Mason, our political editor. Faisal Islam, our economics editor. You can listen to the budget on what today, at least, we should call the world at 12:30, because
that's right.
Sarah will be on air early. 20 past, I'm being told now. 12:20. On air early, because the Chancellor, of course, stands up at 12:30, and she'll be on air with expert analysis as well as the speech live that you can listen to there.
It is 19 minutes past eight, and for decades, the best-known faces in America have chosen to weigh in with their thoughts, their endorsements at election time. This time around, think Beyoncé and Kamala Harris, Hulk Hogan and Donald Trump. The polling company YouGov recently found that more Americans think celebrity involvement in politics hurts American democracy than helps it. So how important are those celebrity endorsements in presidential campaigns? Can they really shift the dial? Mark Harvey is Associate Professor at the University of St. Mary in Kansas and author of Celebrity Influence, Politics, Persuasion and Issue-Based Advocacy. He explores that question for us.
You can't start a fire without a spark. This gun's for hire. Even if we're dancing in the dark.
Yeah, that was Bruce Springsteen. He appeared at a campaign event with Barack Obama and doing quite a bit of campaigning for Kamala Harris lately. Made his first appearance back campaigning for candidate John Kerry a long time ago, so long-term Democratic supporter.
To make this a reality. We're all part of something much bigger. We must vote.
So Beyonce made an appearance on Friday with Kamala Harris that did not go unnoticed by Donald Trump. Trump seemed to be a little bit put off that Beyonce would make this appearance with Harris. Seemed a little bit upset that he were dancing and having a good time, at least a little bit defensive about that.
Joe Biden is asleep. Kamala is at a dance party with Beyonce.
One thing I think is really interesting and maybe applicable in this situation is the role of identity. And I think that's one reason why the Harris campaign is not just deploying Beyonce everywhere, but she's actually putting Beyonce in Houston, which is her hometown.
Haley, Memorial, Southwest Side, North Side, all the way down to Most City.
And in that way, she can identify with the audience in a way that a typical celebrity would not. That's why Harris is also deploying Julia Roberts in Georgia, Eminem in Michigan, probably trying to make that personal connection with those audiences.
I'm not just MAGA. I'm dark, gothic MAGA.
One of those high-profile people to support Donald Trump is Elon Musk. And of course, he is super rich and super famous. But for those of us who study celebrities academically, we don't exactly put him in the celebrity box. Why? Because we generally know that rich and famous people with lots of money tend to be pretty influential, so there's not really anything that interesting in that question.
The only thing I see in here are a bunch of hard-working men and women that are real Americans, brother.
So if we're talking about celebrities, there are a few who have come out on behalf of Donald Trump. He had a Madison Square Garden appearance the other night where Hulk Hogan spoke. Hulk Hogan also spoke at the Republican National Convention. Kid Rock is another really high-profile person.
Let me see where you're at. Say fight!
The irony is that Trump tends to be critical of the idea of celebrity endorsements themselves. These people are a little more unconventional, so it makes for a bit more of a consistent message from the Trump campaign standpoint.
And we have some breaking news right now. Taylor Swift and a picture of her and her cat. She has just posted that she watched the debate tonight and that she is endorsing Kamala Harris because, in her words, she...
Swift has been quite influential when it comes to trying to get people to actually show up and register to vote. So we can actually measure when she goes out and says, hey, let's go out and vote, then it has actually increased the number of people who have registered to vote in the upcoming election.
Well, you should be.
There is one example of a time where celebrities, or a celebrity anyway, was very influential, and that was Oprah Winfrey in 2008 supporting Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton in the 2008 election, where he went on to become the candidate for president that year.
There are those who say that Barack Obama, they say maybe this isn't the time, maybe we need to wait 4 more years or 8 more years.
Another example of identities at play has a lot to do with the Harris campaign trying to court the Puerto Rican vote. There are lots of Puerto Rican communities all over the United States, and especially in swing states. While Harris is out there trying to court the Puerto Rican vote, we have a split screen where Trump at Madison Square Garden has a comedian up there who refers to Puerto Rico as an island of trash. And the next thing you know, Bad Bunny, a very high-profile Puerto Rican pop star, with 46 million followers on Instagram, now has endorsed the Harris campaign. And from that standpoint, that may be a really significant thing. But it's important to remember that celebrities are not infinitely influential across lots of issues. They certainly can't convince people to change their mind on extremely set in issues. Like Taylor Swift is not going to convince anyone to change their mind on gun policy in the United States, because politics is so polarized in the United States, looking at Donald Trump or Kamala Harris is a lot like looking at those more extreme issues where it may be much harder for them to persuade people to vote for one person or the other.
Mark Harvey, their associate professor at the University of St. Mary in Kansas, and now at 26 minutes past 8, here's Mike with the sports news.
Nick, thank you. Good morning. We still have the prospect of all four home nations competing at a major women's football tournament for the very first time. Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland all booked their place last night in the final round of qualifying for next summer's European Championship. England, of course, defending champions, are already at the tournament. This evening, Ruud van Nistelrooy will take charge of Manchester United for the first time as interim manager. They host Leicester in the League Cup. But now, let's talk racing with one of the most successful national hunt jockeys of the last 20 years. Davy Russell won the Cheltenham Gold Cup in 2014, but is surely most famous for making history on board the great Tiger Roll, who in 2019 became the first horse to defend the Grand National since Red Rum in 1974. In a new autobiography, Davy reveals all about his life in racing, from glory at Aintree to more challenging times, like his struggles to make the weight for some big races. So, what was his strategy for making sure he didn't tip the scales?
It was kind of like cold turkey. When my weight was allotted for the race, then it was just no food, sweat it out, whether I was running or I was doing it in a bath or I was doing it in a sauna, anything from 6 to 8 pounds. But the problem with me was when the races were over, I'd stop at McDonald's on the way home or I'd have a bar of chocolate, and I was never really sitting down eating what I should do. So later in my career, it got an awful lot easier. I started eating the breakfast, I started eating eggs. Eggs were a huge part of my weight balancing out, because, you know, a couple of boiled eggs in the morning compared to nothing. I used to eat absolutely zero from when I'd wake up in the morning until I'd finish riding. I had very little energy in my system. I was getting cranky and fighting with people and different things, but that was just bad management on my own part, and I'd have no one else to blame, only myself.
Are you telling me you won the Grand National fueled just by two boiled eggs?
Oh, yeah. I had a couple of eggs that morning, yeah. And maybe a cup of tea. You'd have a cup of tea when you get to the races. Yeah, and that's it. That's all you got. And the odd time then you'd have a little square of chocolate just to give you that little sugar kick going out the door.
The Tiger Roll for Davy Russell. It's going to be Grand National glory at last. Tiger Roll gripping on for dear life. And the judge might be required at the Grand National.
First, number 13.
Tiger Roll has got it.
Listen to the roar for Tiger Roll. Tiger Roll is out in front from Magic of Light. He's going to do it again, following in the hoofprints of Red Rum. Tiger Roll has won his second Grand National.
How does it feel listening back to that fantastic, evocative commentary from John Hunt there?
Yeah, and John played such a role in the way he commentates on it. And again, it's a very emotional to listen back to it now. It's hard to believe, to be honest, that I was lucky enough to come across a horse like Tiger Roll and win two Grand Nationals. It's hard to separate them. Both were unbelievable feelings. The first one had a lot going on with the tight finish and...
Yeah, it was a photo finish, wasn't it, in 2018? Yeah. and we heard a little bit in commentary there, but just describe those moments, those seconds where you're waiting to discover whether you've achieved something that presumably you've spent your whole career dreaming of. I mean, they must be agonising seconds.
Yeah, and I tried to just empty my mind of any thought, because there was a lot of negativity in my head to think that I could have just thrown away the Grand National. What I was trying to do was just empty my mind, be patient enough to wait for the result. And I couldn't remember what number I was. The only way you'll know if you're the winner is you'll have to look down at your number. So I had to look down to see what number I was. Now, everybody around me was telling me that I held on, but I couldn't build myself up to feel that I'd won it and to get an emptiness of if I didn't. So I was just trying to keep in the middle somewhere.
And how special a horse was Tiger Roll and your unique relationship with him?
He kind of knows when he's the centre of attention. He's a very intelligent horse. He'd bite you and he'd kick you, or he'd threaten to kick you. He may not kick you, but he would threaten to kick you. And if you stayed in that position for long enough, he'd let you know that you're in the wrong place. But then I could get my young lad Finn, when he was kind of 3 or 4 years of age, and throw him up on his back, and he'd relax in and let Finn ride him around the place, you know. So it's extraordinary. I have some marvellous photos of Finn riding him around when he was a baby. He knows he's a celebrity, but he's looked after like a king, and rightly so.
You have been described as one of the greatest Irish jockeys of all time, and I just want to ask you, what is it about the island of Ireland and horse racing? How did one comparatively small nation develop such a love affair with this sport and assert this global dominance over it?
It's just horses in general. There's different pockets of Ireland. It's nothing but horses. It's very rural. It plays a huge part on that area surviving. You take, for instance, Joseph O'Brien's yard in Owning. There is very little going on in Owning. Only the employment that Joseph O'Brien creates. Again, with the likes of Ballydoyle, again, with all of these stables set around the country. They're all very rural areas. And they create a lot of employment. And what that does then is that bleeds through to the local pub, the local town, and around the local areas that rely on employment to create revenue for them. So, you know, and people accept it and they appreciate what horse racing does for the rural area in Ireland. And then again, it's just a love for the horse, really. And we're kind of reared on it. We're very good at it. And there's this huge amount of horses in the country that people go for just enjoyment, whether they're going for a trot down the beach or whether they're taking part in the Grand National. It goes from the whole scale and everybody is accepted.
That is Davy Russell. I could have spoken to him all morning. His autobiography is out now, and he won the Grand National on a diet of just two boiled eggs. I've got to ask, do you need a bit more than that to get through 3 hours of the Today programme?
No, that's more than enough. Just two boiled eggs.
Yeah, two boiled eggs would be luxury, Mike.
Okay. I see you with a porridge. Yeah, I see you with some hot porridge. Yeah.
Mike, thanks very much indeed. It is 28 minutes to nine. The always engaging More or Less is coming up this morning at 9 o'clock. Here's Tim Harford.
This week, did the introduction of the winter fuel payment under New Labour save thousands of lives? Is it really true that criminals sentenced to 3 years will be out in 2 months? Are elderly drivers vastly more dangerous than those in the prime of life? Southeastern Railway are boasting that they're shifting 50 million leaves from their lines. How do they know, and should we really be impressed? That's More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
What's the weather got in store for us? Well, it's going to be a largely dry day with variable cloud and sunny spells.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It's 27 minutes to nine. Let's get a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is preparing to deliver the first Labour budget in 14 years. She's pledged to grow the economy with increased investment, but has warned that she's had to make difficult decisions in what could be one of the biggest tax-rising budgets in a generation. The 18-year-old accused of murdering three girls in Southport in July is due in court today, charged with possessing a military study of an Al-Qaeda training manual and the poison ricin. BBC News has been told that senior government figures were made aware in the past few weeks that Axel Rudakabana could face the new charges. President Biden is facing criticism after footage emerged of him appearing to call Trump supporters garbage. Mr. Biden said he'd been criticising remarks about Puerto Rico by one supporter, a comedian, at a Trump rally. Spanish police say 51 people are now known to have died in flash floods in southern and eastern regions, including 4 children. Rescue efforts have continued through the night.
Thanks, Lisa. The vote by the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, to halt the work of the UN agency that supports Palestinian refugees, UNRWA, in a matter of months has led to criticism from around the world. Our own parliament heard calls yesterday for sanctions and trade curbs on Israel in response. The Knesset member who proposed the legislation insists that too many of UNRWA's workers are connected to acts of violence, something the agency says it has investigated and, where necessary, acted on. Earlier I spoke to Michael Fakhry, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, who began by telling me how the UN should respond.
The first response, of course, is an attempt for the UN to try and to provide relief for the Palestinians, and that's been proving to be basically impossible. And as I mentioned, Israel is attacking the UN system. It's shooting at peacekeepers in Lebanon. So all that's left now is a political response by the UN. And I think the only way forward is for the UN General Assembly to unseat Israel. And this is the only time this was done was against South Africa during the apartheid era in the mid-1970s. And that would mean to deny Israeli diplomats the ability to take their seat at the General Assembly and to draw a line to say, you're not allowed to starve civilians and you're not allowed to attack the UN system and you're not allowed to break the rules no matter what.
That would be a pretty extraordinary thing to do, to single out a country like that and to essentially ostracize it.
Indeed, and that's to highlight how devastating this banning of UNRWA is. UNRWA's mandate comes from the General Assembly itself, and Israel continues to attack the UN system. Its leader tore up the UN charter before the General Assembly, and they're literally shooting at UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, and they're using starvation. They're declaring their intent to starve civilians. They're executing their starvation plan, and they're doing it. So this is extraordinary by Israel. So I think the only response left is a bare minimum is to draw a line and say this is unacceptable by the international community.
I think Israel would probably push back pretty firmly against the idea that they are deliberately starving civilians. However, your point about the criticism of the UN by Israel, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, is there? I mean, countries are allowed to have political opinions. Countries are allowed to say that they disagree with the direction that the UN has taken.
Oh, indeed, one can disagree with the UN. Myself, as an independent human rights expert, I sometimes will criticize the UN decisions. But what Israel has said is that it denies international law applying to itself. So whenever the Security Council was up to make a decision, Israel would declare, we will not follow the Security Council if it decides against us. And Security Council resolutions are legally binding. Israel declared that it would not comply with the International Court of Justice, and International Court of Justice decisions are binding. So it's not just a political disagreement. It's Israel keeps declaring that it is refusing to abide by international law, and it declares its illegal intent. So on October 9th of last year, Israeli politician said, we are going to lay siege against all of Gaza. This is an announcement of starvation of civilians. So unabashed breaking of and violations of international law time and time again, in which they announce it and then they do it. So at this point, it's ostracized itself.
On a practical note, if the agency, if UNRWA is barred, what stops another UN agency, the likes of, I don't know, UNICEF, going into somewhere like Gaza and simply replicating the services that UNRWA provide at the moment?
Well, first, there's been already a challenge. The World Food Programme has been trying to gain access into Gaza, and it's either severely restricted or denied. And then when UN humanitarian convoys sometimes do make it through, they are attacked by Israeli forces. So we have other UN agencies that are trying to make their way in. That being said, UNRWA is uniquely positioned in that its mandate is approximately 70 years old. It is part of daily life in Gaza and for refugees in the entire region, providing education, humanitarian relief. But most importantly, it houses the claims of the Palestinian refugees that lost their homes and houses in 1947. So the Palestinians have a right to return to their homes and territory, like all refugees in the world. And UNRWA has the archives of these deeds, of these of people's titles to their homes. So Israel has been campaigning against UNRWA for decades.
That was Michael Fakhry, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, speaking to me earlier.
It's now 8:40. China has declared a complete success after launching a new three-person crew to its homegrown space station for 6 months. The country is seeking to expand its exploration of outer space with missions to the moon and beyond. Beijing has made no secret of its plans to send someone to the moon by 2030. But Washington is growing increasingly alarmed at the pace of China's technological advances, which the head of NASA declared as a new space race. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker was granted rare access to the launch base.
Oh. I'm standing at the edge of the Gobi Desert waiting for the launch of Shenzhou 19. This is China's latest mission to its homegrown space station called Tiangong, or Heavenly Palace. The BBC has been given rare access to this launch centre, and I'm just about a kilometre away from the spacecraft itself. So we're expecting one almighty roar. This launch is yet another step in a growing space race, a battle which could eventually decide who owns the moon. The three chosen to fly to China's homegrown space station were introduced from behind glass to prevent infection. They include the country's first female space engineer, Wang Haoci.
I dream of exploring the vastness of space, waving to the stars, and of course, looking back at my homeland. My deepest affection will always be for my motherland, no matter where I am. I will keep striving and working tirelessly.
The team have trained together for a year to conduct experiments and carry out spacewalks. The pilot is a veteran, but both Wang and her crewmate are China's next generation of space explorers. And this year they watched their country carry out an historic first and collect lunar samples from the far side of the moon. China also has a fleet of satellites in space and has plans for many more, a rival to Elon Musk's Starlink. After meeting the astronauts, we were allowed right next to the spacecraft several hours before launch. You can hear the announcements in the background. Final preparations are being made. President Xi has described China's space ambitions as the eternal dream. But every year, that dream gets a little closer. This country is making technological advances with every mission to space. And it has Washington worried. The head of NASA has said that the US and China is in a new space race. Li Yinyang from China's manned spaceflight agency told us the country's discoveries belonged to the world.
I think his concerns are unnecessary. We adhere to the principles of peaceful use, equality, mutual benefit, and joint development.
Hundreds have gathered along the streets in the dark to wave flags and brightly coloured lights as the taikonauts make their last few steps on Earth before heading to the launch site. The brass band strikes up Ode to the Motherland as young children kept up late for the occasion. Their cheeks adorned with the Chinese flag shout every note. This is a moment of national pride. China's rivalry with the US is no longer just based here on Earth. Both could soon be staking territorial claims well beyond this planet.
Laura Bicker there reporting. Now think of the neurologist and father of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, and you may not immediately think about the role that women played in his life, but it is time to think again. A new exhibition opening today at the Freud Museum in London will celebrate the impact of women on Sigmund Freud, alongside a collection of work by women artists inspired by his ideas, artists like Tracy Emin and Paula Rego. Lisa Apignanesi is chair of the Freud Museum and one of the curators of the exhibition. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I have to ask, why women? Is it an acknowledgement or an understanding that the role of women was previously overlooked?
Well, I think women have been marginally overlooked for some time. There's also been a very long-standing debate as to whether Freud was indeed a terrible patriarch who condemned women to awful things, or someone who helped to liberate, as I think, women's intimate private thoughts and put them on the level of philosophy and into the public domain. And a lot of women played into the making of psychoanalysis. So the first patients, the so-called hysterics, and don't forget Freud called himself a hysteric too, developed the way in which, or allowed Freud to develop the way in which therapy would go from then on. In other words, they gave him the idea of the talking cure. That was one of the patients, Bertha Pappenheim, who named it. But also all the others, they showed him how free association, and we must think of free expression too, inside the consulting room would help one think through and live through the experiences that might have gone wrong and shaped symptoms, and bring them back away from those symptoms.
What's so interesting about this exhibition, it's not just about women, but it's also by women. The museum is being stuffed with artworks by women. I mean, apart Indeed. From being done by women, what was the criteria for choosing them?
Well, my sense of this is that the artists who actually have a sense, a very close link to the unconscious, you might say all artists do, but some of them play with it more. I mean, for example, in the case of Paula Rego, she's very interested in the dynamics of family life and the kind of distortions that creep into what we might call love and intimacy, the power that comes into play. And we've put her into the room we call the family room, where Freud's own family, his family of birth, and also the family he made with his wife Martha, are explored. And you get the sense that psychoanalysis is very much something that grows up within the family. It's where your ideas come from, but it's also where artists' ideas, in Paula Rego's case, come from and shape this extraordinarily magical, uncanny work, which is a combination of some of the pictures are from her nursery tales, and others are about mothers and daughters. And we have a unique, for the very first time, seen, I think anywhere in the world, Paula Rego's famous giant chair, which comes from her son's film, Alice in Wonderland. And it's this giant chair on which her dollies, these props that she made to use in her paintings, are shown. And it's magical. I found it magical once it was actually installed. So I think everybody has to come and see that. And then we have Louise Bourgeois, who herself had some 50 years of analysis and constantly wrote in her pictures as well as, in everyday life, how much she hated analysts and analysis, but carried on doing it. And this resistance is, of course, one of the things that makes up the whole idea of an analytic encounter, because none of us are just passively there.
Lisa, there's so much to talk about. We have to leave it there. Sadly, we're out of time. But thank you very much for joining us, and good luck with the exhibition. Lisa Apignanesi, the chair of the Freud Museum there.
It's now 11 minutes to 9. This week we've been hearing about great spooky books for our children's book clubs. We're looking for your recommendations. New and old, Nikki Richards got in touch with an old favourite of hers that she's kept for years.
Hi, my name is Nikki Richards. My spooky book recommendation for kids is The Ghost of Thomas Kemp by Penelope Lively, about a ghost who still believes in witchcraft and witches and sorcery, and what happens when he comes to the modern world. And it's got adventure, it's got peril, it's a really fun adventure story, and I still love it to this day. It was read to me at primary school, I still have a copy.
Please do send your suggestions. We want to hear what ghostly, spooky, fun books you would recommend to children this week. Halloween week, of course. Email us on today at bbc.co.uk or send us a voice note on our WhatsApp number 0330 123 4346. Now, it's 50 years today since The Rumble in the Jungle, the greatest fight of all time, watched, it's estimated, by a billion people around the world, featuring who else? The man who was, who still is, the greatest, Muhammad Ali, in the ring facing George Foreman at the time, undefeated as heavyweight world champion, with the inimitable Harry Carpenter describing the scene on the 30th of October, 1974.
And suddenly Ali looks very tired indeed. In fact, Ali at times now looks as though he can hardly lift his arms up. And he's doing his shuffle. And I don't think Foreman's going to get up. He's trying to beat the count, and he's out! Oh, my God, he's won the title back at 32.
If that doesn't get the hairs on the back of your neck going up, I don't know what does. Even if you don't remember it. And amongst those who don't remember it, but knows all about it, is the boxing writer Tom Gray, who watched tapes of that night alongside Muhammad Ali as they worked together on the book Muhammad Ali, His Life and Times. And he's a deputy editor of Sporting News and former managing editor of The Ring magazine. Tom, did that get the hairs on the back of your neck going up again?
Yeah, you just smile through that. It's probably it's the best moment, I think, in all of sports, or certainly in the 20th century, and with the best commentator doing his job at the time, probably his best line. Absolutely fantastic.
Why? Try and capture why for people who either don't remember it or don't much like boxing. I'm not part of the kind of obsession that I have with Muhammad Ali. What was it about that fight that night that made it so special?
Well, Foreman at the time, as you said, was undefeated, but it was 40 wins and 37 knockouts, and he was considered invincible. A lot of people actually saying at that point he was the greatest heavyweight of all time. He had knocked out Joe Frazier in 2 rounds, knocked out Ken Norton in 2 rounds, and those were the only two men who had beaten Muhammad Ali. So there was a fear that Ali, because of his courage, which he'd already proved at that time, would stay in there and take, you know, inhuman punishment and conceivably lose his life. That was essentially what a lot of people were saying. They were checking where the nearest hospitals were in Zaire so that they could treat him. So Ali wasn't really given a chance in the fight. And then to empty Foreman's tank the way he did, using the strategy known as the rope-a-dope, where he went to the ropes and defended himself and counterpunched beautifully off the ropes, he basically drained Foreman of all his energy and then just knocked him out in spectacular fashion.
But the reason we care about that is because Ali was much more than a boxer, much more than a mere athlete, wasn't he?
Yes, I mean, he was colossal prior to that fight, but if you know, to be honest, after that knockout, he became even bigger. Ali, at that point, after he knocked out George Foreman, was on the cusp of being the most famous man in the world at the time. And these were fights that made the world stop, you know, decades before social media. You couldn't cheat and go on social media and check the result or check the, you know, a clip of the knockout. If you wanted to be involved with that fight, you had to listen to it on the radio or go to the cinema to see it live.
And even more extraordinary because where it was staged in Zaire, staged by an African dictatorship. And I hadn't realised till I read up this morning with Gaddafi, the Libyan dictator, helping pay for some of the money for the two fighters.
Yes, I mean, it was. At that time, there was a crossover point. Most heavyweight championship fights had taken place in the United States up to that point. George Foreman won his title in Jamaica, and then there was Zaire, and then Ali would, after that fight in Manila, which was another dictatorship under the Ferdinand Marcos regime. He fought in Kuala Lumpur. He fought all over the world because the governments would front the money for it in order to basically put their country on the map.
Tom Gray, thank you very much indeed for remembering Rumble in the Jungle. My favourite phrases from the greatest sports writer of all time, the late, great Hugh McElveny, who wrote, "We should have known that Muhammad Ali would not settle for any ordinary resurrection. His had to have an additional flourish. So having rolled away the rock, he hit George Foreman on the head with it."
It certainly made the hairs on the back of my neck go off, and I don't have any hair on the back of my neck. After the news at 9, we're going to hear Tim Harford as he crunches some of the numbers making the headlines this week in More or Less. And then The World at 1 is going to be on air early this lunchtime at 12:20 to cover the budget statement live. To follow that statement and the latest updates and analysis all through the day, you can head to the live news stream on BBC Sounds. It's a superb service. To listen, go to the BBC Sounds homepage and scroll along the live dial until you find live news.
And in our last few moments on the programme, let's focus on something that is at least 400 years old, has a girth of 8 metres, but was hidden for many years.
I've been walking, walking these shores all my days, but with you by my side, I am walking on the waves. I've been walking.
It is the Skippinish Oak, and it was named after that Cayley band which stumbled on it, hidden in a spruce plantation in the Highlands. And the reason we're talking about it today is it's just been awarded the Tree of the Year title. And we're joined by Andrew Stevenson from the Skippinish Cayley Band. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Exciting news that it's got Tree of the Year, and it's something that's been an important part of your life for many years.
Yeah, it's very exciting. As you know, the Woodland Trust run the competition Tree of the Year every year, and we were notified this year that the Skippinish Oak had been nominated, which was very exciting. And then we tried to help a bit with promotion and things, and it eventually won.
Oh, promotion, because it was a public vote, won it. Now, tell us about it. You were told about it by your father, I understand.
Yeah, many, many years ago. Oh, gosh, probably over 30 years ago, my father told us of this tree that was kind of was hidden in a forestry commercial plantation. And my father knew of it from before the plantation had been planted, and he was describing just how large it was. And eventually I went into the wood and had a rummage about and found the tree, and it was almost completely smothered with conifers at that point.
Oak tree, enormous in size, hundreds of years old, but it had sort of got buried away, really.
I think it just been kind of lost in time. And a few years later, the earliest days of our band, we started out as a kind of Cayley band, and we were playing a small function locally for some woodland enthusiasts. And I was chatting to them after the show, and I presumed they would have known of this tree, given the magnitude of it, and they'd never heard of it. And I think they were kind of doubting me at first that this tree existed.
Because of the size? Because what, 8 metres in girth?
Yeah, just the size. It's massive. I mean, it's I think I measured it in old money. I think it was nearly 30 feet circumference.
Mm. And has it been cleared away a bit so that you could admire it, or is it still surrounded by all these spruce?
Oh, no. Well, I told these woodland enthusiasts, they came up to my house the following day, and I took them up the hill and showed them the tree. And since then, there's been quite a bit of work to kind of preserve the tree and maintain the tree. They've slowly opened up let some sunlight in around about it, and it's kind of thriving again, which is great.
And so, it's got future awards that it might still win. There is, I read, a European Tree of the Year contest.
Yeah, so the Woodland Trust competition has won the UK, extended to the European competition for next year, which is very exciting. And to try and help that along, we've committed to composing a new song, and we're going to release it. Well, we're going to debut it for the first time ever live at the Ovo Hydro next September, on the 27th of September next year. So we'll do a sort of feature on the tree. And we've got.
So you'll be able to go to that gig in Glasgow. You'll be able to listen to it, no doubt, as well.
Absolutely.
And words dedicated to the tree, Andrew.
Yeah, and we're hoping to. There was a beautiful painting done by Adibanji from the One Show. We're hoping to get the painting on the large screens at the stage at the Hydro. And